won't lie. Long as I see no wrong, I won't need to testify.
Hey, good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, May 21st, 2018. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our access code is 449-389. If anybody would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, it's plural, questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is going to be Matthew chapter 27, verse 32. We're going to read through, I think, verse 56. So it's chapter 27, 32 through 56. And as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by the name, Simon by name, and they compelled him to bear his cross. And when they will come into a place called Gagatha, that is to say, a place of the skull, they gave him vinegar to drink mingled with gall. And when he had tasted thereof, he would not drink. And they crucified him and parted his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet. They parted my garments among them, and upon my vesture did they cast lots. And sitting down, they watched him there, and set him up over his head the accusation written, "This is Jesus, King of the Jews." Then were there two thieves crucified with him, one on the right and another on the left. And they that passed by reviled him, wagging their heads, and saying, "Thou that destroyest the temple and buildest it in 3 days, save yourself. If thou be the Son of God, come down from the cross." Likewise also the chief priests mocking him with the scribes and the elders said, "He saved others, himself he cannot save. If he be the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him. He trusted in God, let him deliver him now. If he will have him, for he said, I am the Son of God." The thieves also, which were crucified with him, cast the same in his teeth. Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land unto the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, "Eli, Eli, lamana sabachthani," I'm not sure how to pronounce that. That is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Some of them that stood there, when they heard that, said, "The man called for Elijah." And straightway one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a reed and gave him to drink. The rest said, let us see whether Elijah will come to save him. Jesus, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom, and the earth did quake and the rocks rent. And the graves were open, and many bodies of the saints that slept arose and came out of their graves after his resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared unto many. Now, when the centurion and they that were with him watching Jesus saw the earth quake and those things that were done, they feared greatly, saying, "Truly this was the Son of God." And many women were there beholding afar off, which followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering unto him, among which was Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Josie, and the mother of Zebedee's children. Okay, that was Matthew chapter 27, verses 32 through 56. All right, let's see. I guess the big announcement for tonight is that we did finally file the paperwork. It got out today. I was hoping to get it out Friday or Saturday, but it just didn't happen. But it did go out in today's mail. We did post all of the paperwork up online right now. It could be found up at nationallibertyalliance.org. If you go to, you can find it under the grand jury, and you can click on Amendment 2, the Second Amendment. That's one of the ways to find the case. Actually, there's a couple of ways to find it, but that's the quickest. And what we filed up there, they had given us an order, two orders or three orders over the past, 20 or so days. And also we responded with a couple of things. We also updated the list. We added two more plaintiffs. But we also responded with a show cause and an amicus curiae. And we did take a look a little bit at that last week. We read a few parts out of it. We got it pretty much perfected over the weekend. And again, we put it out today. So we'll see how that goes. We're also working on a writ of mandamus. which we hope to get out in the next 2 days or so, maybe a day or two. Could go out tomorrow. They're going to be very short. It's going to be one page, maybe two. I don't think it's going to be much longer than that. And it's going to be to the United States Supreme Court concerning what they're doing here in New York and actually what they're doing here in all the courts. But look at the Constitution. We vested one United States Supreme Court, just one. And the inferior courts are federal courts, and the responsibility of their actions in that court is the responsibility belongs to the United States Supreme Court. And we're going to remind them of that and show them where in the Constitution it requires that they are to really, oversee these courts, and when these people are in bad behavior, they need to be removed from the bench. I don't know that the United States Supreme Court has the power to remove someone from the bench. I'd have to look into the Constitution for that. We do know that that the Congress has that power, and I'm sure if the United States Supreme Court required of the Congress to remove people who were not obedient to the Constitution, well, they also could call for a grand jury to come in and we can indict them. And, of course, that's what we're here for. But they can call another group of people if they want and indict these judges in order to remove them. That's another way to get rid of them. But now it's time for, I think, the United States Supreme Court to step up. I think we have to put them, on notice. We have to see where they go with this thing. We have plenty of things to do depending on which way the case goes. It is clear when you read in the papers, because it is very crystal clear that they intend on throwing this case and the New York case out on the Second Amendment. That's pretty clear. Hopefully our paperwork that we've sent in should hopefully shake them up enough to realize that maybe they shouldn't do that and that we see what they're doing. We do know, I did get a letter, something about something was filed, and I went up there and Jan went up there, and we didn't find any new filings, a motion to dismiss. Now, maybe there was a letter concerning that, of course, and maybe that's what the judge was referencing because he had sent a letter out, which I had received in the mail, and we did post everything up there, I think. I'll double-check to make sure all the letters have been up there. Anyway, that case is moving on. They're, I'm sure, shaken up by this case because they can't respond to our case. The only one thing they could do is throw us out. They know their time is running out. At some point, they have to answer or they default. That's the only thing they could do. And I don't think they have much of a leg to stand on. I think if you read the letter of charges that the district attorney put upon us and then the response to that in our show cause, I think it becomes quite clear that they don't have a leg to stand on even to throw us out of the court. But anyway, we'll talk more about that as time goes on, and we'll see what their next move is, and then we'll see how the response goes also with the United States Supreme Court. And again, what we're asking the United States Supreme Court to do is what we're going to ask them. We're doing a writ of mandamus to them to move that court to control and correct the courts that they are responsible for overseeing, and particularly the one in the Northern District here with this judge and this magistrate. So anyway, we'll see how those things go. I know there was a couple of things. I'm looking to see if there's anything else that I want to bring up. I guess nothing else at this moment. Jan, do you have anything? I know Jim wanted to speak a little bit and bring some things up. I know also we want to try to get Crystal into the queue, or maybe we can we'll try to get her into the queue as soon as I hit the button on the queue so she can be first in line and we could talk a little bit about some of the problems she's gotten. And we started talking privately on this and I didn't get a good recording at all on that call. Two calls came in at the same time, and it just didn't record. So I'm going to try to go over through that information, what she might be able to do and what the process is. and it'll be recorded on tonight's call. And other people might have the same situation, and hopefully the information we give might be valuable to someone else also. So that's why we wanted to do it tonight on the call. And also it'll be recorded so people can go back and rewind and see once what they might do. But, Jen, do we have anything, anybody that any questions or anything?
We have a question here from a fellow member. It says, I was reading on the subject of injured parties and how it pertained to two or more individuals and that the state can never be the injured party. Many individuals today appear to be on the defendant's stand for offenses against the state, i.e. D.C. versus Heller, and that is one of many. I try to explain to others about this, but they seem to need more information. Could NLA please elaborate on this further?
Well, look, at common law is simple. The key point to common law is do no harm. If you harm someone, you have to make restitution. Hopefully that could be done without having to go to court. But, we want to set up a process where the administrators in every county would have that opportunity to patch that problem up and hopefully not get it into the court, because that's the way it should be done. And if they can't, then the grand jury would get it, and they might take the opportunity. We would suggest to them to take the opportunity to talk to the individuals and see if they can't patch it up. If not, they can send it into the court for the potential judgment on it and let the jury decide. But these situations where, the state somehow is injured, it just doesn't exist. The state cannot be the injured party. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that if someone was committed some crime, that had to do with working for the state or something, maybe they were an employee and they embezzled or something, of course, that's embezzlement. It's a crime, and it doesn't matter who you embezzle from. So we have to use our common sense on that. But for instance, we do know that the IRS takes a lot of people into court, and they end up going to jail or paying these extreme large fines and both. And, of course, that's the kind of situation that's a serious problem. Also, code violations. People go to jail for code violations, and the state comes in, and there's no victim. There's no injured party. That are putting these people in jail, specifically for maybe they smoke marijuana or something in that court, or whatever the case may be. The problem is that these courts that are putting people in jail are what's called nisi prius courts. In other words, they're administrative courts. They have no power to fine or incarcerate. And yet they do. And as long as we believe that they can, they'll continue doing so. And until we open the minds of the people to realize these things, they'll continue to put people in jail. And hopefully at some point in the near future, we will be able to turn that around. And we'll force all of these people to be released from jail that have been brought in jail for some kind of a code violation, And that's what I presume the individual's talking about, is some kind of a code violation, which the state comes in and there's no injured party and so on. But there's not much more to say than that. By the way, am I still coming through? Because I see a sign telling me a warning, my server connection error.
Yeah, you dropped out a little bit there, and then you came back on pretty good and pretty steady.
All right, I have no control on my board. I might have to log out and log back in, but I don't know why this is doing this. This happened to me Sunday also. But anyway, I'll wait until before rebooting this. I'll wait till we finish up with any other. Is there any other questions?
No, there was no other questions. Jim Bearson would like to add some words about the foreclosure updates.
Okay, while he's doing that, I'm going to reboot my my page here. I can hear still, so I'm connected with the audio. But I'm going to reboot my panel. But go ahead.
Okay, I'll just unmute you, Jim.
Okay.
You're on.
Good morning, or good day, good evening, everyone. I always get nervous talking on the phone here. Yeah, I just wanted to say that we are, I think we're making some headway here. I got an update from one of our people that had a non-judicial foreclosure done by us, and she keeps an eye on the court and what's going on down there, and apparently there's a judge there that is not going along with the status quo. She's just not granting these non-judicial foreclosures. As a matter of fact, from what we understand, she's pushing them off to another county. So we got to think that that's a positive sign. It was kind of like a couple of years ago when we had a sheriff deputy newly retired that called in and said that we were having an effect with the traffic stops by going to court and complaining about it and objecting to the situation at hand. And he said that, you know, back then, this was a couple of years ago, that keep up doing what you're doing, you know. It's kind of the death of a 10,000 cuts that we can, you know, finally make some headway on here to where we start convincing these people that are supposed to be serving us that they're actually not doing their job as they're corrected to, as they're supposed to, you know, and that we're correcting them. So I just wanted to say that. So if there's any more non-judicial foreclosures that you know of people and that had their property taken away, we need to strike while the iron's hot. So that's all I had to say.
Okay. John, are you back on again?
I'm still here.
Okay, shall I bring Crystal up? We can just
let me open up Q&A and let Crystal get into Q&A, hit star 6, and then we'll pull you first and we'll talk to you. Anybody else? Crystal's in there now. Anybody else that's new to the call or been trying to get a hold of us for a while maybe and hasn't been able to, those people should get onto the Q&A right now first by hitting star 6. If you have any questions or comments, and
can you hear me?
Let's give them a moment or two. Yeah, I can hear you. Let's give them a moment or two to do that, then others can get into the queue. Go ahead, Ron.
I just wanted to say that I got news this week that a bunch of judges were put into the district courts in New York State. That Donald Trump has added numerous judges. I think it was seven and a marshal and a pro. He put a prosecutor down in New York City and the Bronx that was an ex-JAG officer. It was the prosecutor or the judge, which you have to wonder if he's not getting ready for these military tribunals. But that's good news for us because New York and California are kind of the tips of the spear. And Donald Trump knows New York. He knows the crap that's in our courts. And I think that we're going to get relief before anybody else because I think that's where he's focusing. Because that's the worst of it, and he has to drain the swamp. Look, they can't try any of these people until they get good courts, unless they're going to do them all in Gitmo, you know what I mean? And I don't think he wants to do all of them because the people will say that he's doing a coup and doing a secret government and all that crap. So they are getting indicted through the regular indictment process, you know what I mean? They're letting grand juries indict them, but they may decide to try them in Gitmo, like especially big people like Obama and Hillary, when they get indicted, not if, it's when at this point, I believe, because they're not going to be able to get a judiciary unless they completely clean out the New York one, because they've all been appointed by Obama, and I'm sure they all have skeletons in their closets that you know they have the chains on them that Hillary or Obama could pull. So that's a problem. So anyway, we have to look and see what happens for us. They did say it was the Southern District, the Western District, and I heard the Eastern, but I didn't hear anything about the Northern District, which is the one we're in, with our cases. So I don't know. I do want to, I'll get some more information and see if I can't find that out. And the other thing I was going to say, look, this paperwork we put in, we didn't go over it. But everything that's in this show cause is what we're talking about. All the answers are there. It's very good. I mean, just like that guy said, well, what about these people with their that are injured parties against the state and all that? And it's right in this case here, you know, on paragraph 135, where the Supreme Court unlawfully created Roman civil administration courts called courts of equity via the said rules, which buried all access to we the people's courts of justice. The unconstitutional rules deny access to our courts of justice by requiring a filing of a civil cover sheet that provides for only a civil court. That's the problem, because they feel comfortable that they have you in some kind of a contract thing, and that they're doing an equity thing on you, and the Constitution doesn't enter in, which is not really the way it's supposed to be, because the Constitution runs the equity courts too. But this is what these judges are taught. And so you've had your remedy, because they give you Social Security and they give you this and they give you that. And so that was the remedy for taking your rights away and taking your court away and taking your money away. So unless you can get in the court and make it Article III and stick to a common law venue, which is what we're trying to do very hard. I don't know that there's anybody out there that I know of that knows how to do that. Maybe one or two people know how to object and hold their feet to the fire. But, you know, this is something that's just coming to, in vogue now, since we're doing it. And since a couple of, you know, Judicial Watch is on their butts with the debt of 1,000 cuts. And, you know, they don't want to answer and say, no, the Constitution is no longer in effect. So they try all their statutory dancing to get you and to dismiss you. So, I mean, look, they're writing letters back and forth. They're not even making motions in our case. They're doing letter motions. What the heck is that, you know? But anyway, that the show cause is like a condensation of everything that we've been doing here. You know, it's come to a head to these documents. And I believe that the writing that's done, we have sharpened the spear here, because the writing is much more pointed, much more clear. It says more in a simpler terms than we ever did, and so it's much more powerful. You know, look at when you start these things, even a doctor goes in and he's a resident and he's in a hospital and he gets better and better. That everybody said, well, what are you going to do about that? Well, look, at a lot of times we waited to see what was going on and we figure it out as we go. We're not some super duper experts in the court. We're not lawyers. But we do have common sense, and we do have discernment, and we do have the ability to look at things in a way that's with a free mind. You see, that's the difference. People have been so programmed. You can't, when you're programmed, it's like Samuel Clemens said, he said, look, it's not what you don't know that gets you. And that's Mark Twain, by the way. He says, it's what you think you know that ain't so that gets you. And so therein lies the problem. So, you know, that's where we're at. And if you read this case, I hear questions coming in, and a lot of the answers to those questions are in the words in this case and in the footnotes. So read them. It's an education. And I believe that these last papers we filed are some of the best that we ever put in. So that's what I wanted to say. And I think things are looking up, because I think, look at Jim, you just mentioned some stuff. I think it's going to get even more than that, because we got these new judges in and we got these new prosecutors in. And you know what that means? That means even the ones that are in there now, they're going to take notice. They're going to stop their baloney, because it's going to – how much can they move? Even in the third district, if in the second district, they're over there throwing judges and prosecutors out and doing constitutional cases, believe me, they'll all catch on really quick, and that's my hope. And I do believe that that's what's going to happen. So it is good news, and we should be very encouraged by that. And it looks like things are starting to take off. I mean, we've had quite a few advances here, you know, as far as getting the word out. And look, they're still putting They're still putting our stuff on the docket. So the clerk is not listening to the judge. So then we know that we've made some dissension there. The judge complained, I said this case is closed. Don't send any more paperwork. And you go in there on PACER, and sure enough, the last paper we put is on PACER. Well, what does that mean? I know what it means. You all should know what it means, too. Anyway, I rest. Did I put you to sleep?
Yeah, I had my mic muted. Sorry, had my mic muted.
Oh, I hope I did. I was hoping I didn't say that into the air.
All right. Okay, before we go to Crystal, I just want to cover something really quick. And this is something, you know, that I'm just coming to really understand. I didn't know it before. All this letter writing stuff, this stems from ultimately in their rules under Rule 12. And if an individual, let's say the defendant or the, well, in this case, it's usually the defendant that does this because whoever files the paperwork, of course, is not looking to get the court case, dismissed. But in rule, under Rule 12, there is a process, and they have to get leave of court. Now, again, I never knew this before, but from going through this process, and I read it incorrectly at first, and then I started to see some things, and I looked a little closer, and it's very hard to discern, in my opinion, but because it's very obscure the way they wrote this. But they make what's called a letter motion to dismiss, and they're looking for a leave of court, and they can make a motion to dismiss if you fall into a certain category. Let me see if I got this list here right now. Maybe this is on the other one. I think it is. Yeah, it's Rule 12, and they have to first get permission from the court to do this. So they write this letter motion and say they'd like to make a motion for dismissal for whatever it is that they want to get rid of it for. In this case, they want to get rid of it for under the sixth one, which is failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. I believe that's the one they're going for. But in the letter, they have to state why, and they have to have good cause in the letter why they want to make this motion. And they don't have to get too deep into it. But what they have made, the motion that they had made and the words that they had said, they connected us to sovereign citizens and claiming that we don't believe in government and the rule of law and the courts and, you know, whatever. They, you know, you can read it in the papers when you go up line and look. You'll see the notes that the defendant's representative put in there, the attorney general. And then how the judge gave them leave of court and gave them an additional 45 days. What I'm objecting to very specifically is a couple of things. First of all, they lied or they put fraud into their paperwork in order to get this by claiming us to be sovereign citizens, which really what they're saying is we're cop killers. We don't believe in any government. And they do say that we don't believe in government, that government is not something that they have to adhere to. That we have to adhere to. That's what they're claiming. But if you read through it, the judge should have looked at the papers we filed to see if that has any truth to it. I mean, to blindly go forward and just say, okay, fine, we'll give you the 45 days and we'll allow you to make a motion for dismissal, okay? And so that's what she did. It was the judge is a female. Yeah, the judge did that. So that's what the judge did. She did that. And so we wrote a paper in response to that. I think we totally destroyed their positions. We referred back to our paperwork, and we are all for a government, or the proper government as a republic, and that we are law-abiding citizens. I mean, we didn't, not citizens, but people. But they do try to make the point that we're not law-abiding. And ultimately, it is them that is not law-abiding. They're the ones that's not, adhering to the law, behaving correctly. But anyway, as you go through this, it's very, very clear on the failure to claim. It says the general rule in appraising the sufficiency of a complaint for failure to state a claim is that A, complaint should not be dismissed unless it appears beyond doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts in support of his claim, which would entitle him to relief. Okay? And that's very important because that's the only point that they make on a failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. Now, there's only a few things that they can make this motion on. Let's see, there's a total of seven, and I'll just read through them very quickly. Number one, if the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction, the court indeed does have subject matter jurisdiction. If federal court must hear this case because it's a constitutional case. Two, if they lack personal jurisdiction. Well, they definitely have personal jurisdiction for numerous reasons. We're going up against the governor, and we're going up against both houses, and they are located in Albany County, and that's where we filed the papers, so they have personal jurisdiction. And it's also the capital of New York, and there's where the battle belongs. Also on that, an improper venue, and again, the Northern District of New York is the state capital where the defendants under the color of law violated the plaintiff. That's where the crime against the people took place. So they violated the plaintiff's unalienable rights. Therefore, the plaintiff did file in a proper venue. Number four, insufficient process, and that's connected to insufficient service of process, which may be maybe you serve papers without the summons or you lack the necessary papers that they need to respond. So you have to make sure you have all those papers. And we did describe all those papers in our service, and we did give it to the sheriff. And so we had the sheriff serve it, and they listed all of our papers. We did file our papers, and you can see that up on our website and also up on Pacer if you want to go look. So they can't go after us for insufficient process. They can't say there's insufficient service of process. The next is failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. And again, I'll read that again. The general rule in appraising the sufficiency of a complaint for failure to state a claim is that a complaint should not be dismissed unless it appears beyond doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts in support of his claim which would entitle them to relief. Clearly, they can't get us on that. Number seven, and the last one, is failure to join a party under Rule 19. And all parties involved in this action have been joined. It's ultimately the governor, and it's the both houses that committed the crime against the people by denying our right to the Second Amendment and injuring us from being able to exercise our unalienable rights. So there really is no place, or no positioning for them to be able to throw us out of the court. But they are really, you know, looking for a way to get rid of us because they do not want to answer. Now, if you read both papers, one is that we filed, and both of them were filed today. One was written up to be filed on Friday. It didn't go out. And the other one was completed this morning, but they both went out. One is a show cause, and the other one is an amicus curiae. The amicus curiae comes from the grand jury, and the show cause comes from the plaintiffs. What an amicus curiae is, you can find that on the very front page of that paper, and I'll just read it. Basically, it's in the United States District Court for the Northern District of New York, and it's the plaintiff versus the defendants, and it's a brief of amicus curiae, which is the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, Kings of the Bench in this court of record in support of the plaintiff, coming in as a next friend. And this is the purpose of what's called an amicus curiae, where someone that has skin in the game, so to speak, and is watching a case and wants to pipe their two cents in. And clearly the grand jury is very interested in this case, and because this does affect all Americans. It affects everyone here in New York, and if this case is won, it will affect everybody in the United States, such a case, because we will pursue it in every federal district. Well, not every federal district, but at least one federal district. Maybe what we'll do if we have to is we'll go after the judiciary in every state from one federal district, maybe from the District of New York, because that's where we're at. So we can extend this beyond. But besides that, they're going to work day and night to try to throw this case out. And if they don't throw this case out, they've got a serious problem because now they got to answer. If they do throw this case out, well, that brings us to the next move. And I don't know whether I mentioned this, but I think I did in the beginning of this, that we are sending a writ of mandamus to the United States Supreme Court. Writ of mandamus is we command you. It's going to come from the grand jury, which is the highest tribunal in the land, okay, higher than the United States Supreme Court. So it's going to come from the grand jury to the United States Supreme Court. We're writing this right now, hopefully get it done tomorrow, maybe get it out tomorrow or the following day. Writ of mandamus, moving that court to do their constitutional duty, and that is to correct this lower court and command them to obey the Constitution and to allow us to have what is our right to a court of justice. Because that's the other thing. There are five issues that this show cause covers. And one of those issues is the fact that they're denying us our jurisdiction. They're saying that we have to stay in a civil court. And we're saying we're not in a civil court. We're in a common law court. There is no way to get into an Article III court with the proper jurisdiction under the common law. They don't want to allow that. But that's the battle. And it's always been the battle. It's been the battle from day one. We find ourselves in courts far into our Constitution. And the federal district courts, all 94 of them, I presume, are all courts foreign to our Constitution. We also discovered in our working and studying these things that the rules of the court were written by the judiciary. And in the process of writing these rules, let me see if I can find this real quick. I think it's in this one here. In the process of filing this, in the process of writing the rules, Congress added a probably faster for me to go into a file and open up the rules of the court. Let me do that because I think we really need to read this. Okay, I got it. Rules of the court, Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Okay, first of all, the fact that it's called Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, okay, in this process they have created another court. A court not of record, a court of statutes, a statutory court, because that's what a civil court is. And I know it's confusing. It took me a while to really see this, but it has become clear, and we do have some U.S. Supreme Court cases that make this clear, and we do have them noted inside our show clause. But what the rules, when what happened was that Congress wrote the original rules. And the judiciary was not happy with the rules that they had written. And they said, you really don't understand how the court system works. So, and then Congress says, well, okay, fine. You write the rules, and then we'll bless them for you. And of course, they would be expected to make whatever corrections. But they didn't have the knowledge, the judicial knowledge, I don't think, to really understand what these rules really did. I've been finding problems with the rules from day one, the first time I started reading these rules. I find problems all over the place. And now it seems very clear to me what these problems are. They've actually created courts. Now, the rules of civil, the rules, when Congress allowed them to do it, and that was given, the job was given to the United States Supreme Court to do. And I'm wondering, I got to believe they allowed the whole judiciary to work on this, all the federal district judges. And maybe they allowed them to do it, then they sent it up to the Supreme Court. And maybe there were guns to people's heads. I don't know. I have no idea how the United States Supreme Court allowed this to go through, but they did because they should have understood this. But Congress did not. It was just another, again, a covert action by the bar. Ultimately, this is a bar-written paper. There's no doubt about it. It's got the fingerprints of the bar everywhere, just like a lot of acts that have been written going way back, shows the fingerprints of the bar. We can go all the way back to the very first Act of Congress, which was the Judiciary Act of 1789, and we can find the fingerprints of the bar in there already. And, of course, it wasn't the American bar in those days because the American bar didn't get created until the 1870s, I think, somewhere in that neighborhood. And they really didn't take real strong hold until later on. But the Bar Association from Britain had been working here in America for a very long time. And they had access and were bringing paperwork into the Congress. They had to have been writing it. I mean, Congress was not capable of writing these things. So these people had to have been writing these things and getting them through. Maybe a congressman here would bring it in or someone there would bring it in, and then they'd pass it. And they didn't see, the dangers of what they were passing, because it's a little piece here and a little piece there over time, and it's constructive law. And that's what it's called, constructive law, when you construct one piece of law over another to build something. And what they're building ultimately is a statutory prison. And that's what they have constructed, and that's what we're in, and what we're trying to get out of this prison. And that's really our battle. But what Congress did do after they gave them the ability to write this, maybe some of the other congressmen saw some problems. Maybe they couldn't win the battle. And they said, okay, let's get this rule in here. The authority for these rules, let's write this, and it's written in Title 28, United States Code, subsection 2072, and it is also posted in the very beginning of the rules of civil procedure. And it says, rules of procedure and evidence, power to prescribe. Now, look at the power and the authority given to these people were to write rules of procedure and rules of evidence. That was the power, that was the job, and this went way beyond it. They legislated all kinds of powers in here, and that's why we have these problems. But because of this rule, and we're bringing this to the attention of the court here, 2072, it says here in 2072A, the Supreme Court shall have the power to prescribe general rules of practice and procedure. That's one, general rules of practice and procedure. And two, rules of evidence for cases in the United States District Courts, including proceedings before magistrate judges thereof and courts of appeals. Very simple, okay? It's a process that they really created, but they went beyond it, as I mentioned. It's policies and procedures. It's form. And nobody's against policies and procedures. Nobody's against forms. It's good to have a form, an idea. That doesn't mean you have to use that form. But we should try to be as collectively the same as possible, so there's procedures and processes, and it all makes sense. But they went, again, they took it and went far beyond it. In B, 2072B, it says, and this is the most important one, and this is what we're using in the court. Such rules shall not abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive right. All laws in conflict with such rules shall be of no further force or effect after such rules have taken effect. So they're null and void. And we're making the points to these rules that are repugnant to the Constitution, these rules that are outside the Constitution, that never, they don't have no authority, no power to do, and they have no power to legislate, because that's what they've done here in the rules. They legislated the powers. It's always a rule. When you find yourself getting kicked out of court, it's always a rule, and it's always 12. Rule 12, almost always. I haven't heard of anything else that they use, but use 12. And they always throw you out for not stating a claim. And we really haven't understood that correctly. At least I haven't until now, just recently. Now I understand exactly what they have done. And we have to become educated here in this area. So that's how they did it. That's what they're doing, and this is how we're going to stop it, is we're going to use their rules, which clearly state, if it has any effect of repugnancy to the Constitution, it's null and void, and they can't continue. Okay, with that,
Don't go on. Wait a minute. I'm going to add something. Right. We're going to move slow tonight.
Okay, I'm a turtle.
I got one other question for you. We don't have posted anywhere their responses to us. I mean, we have our stuff, but we don't really have what they sent to us, right?
All yeah, everything that they have, any letter that they have written is posted. Any decision that the court has made, we've posted. Everything is up there, but
so
no, they have not responded to anything we've said.
Right, so people can go through, and I mean that one letter where they claim we were sovereign citizens, that's all in there,
I would suggest, look at anybody who's not read this case. This case is an education from day one. This is the case, if anyone should understand, this is the case that they should understand. This is the case that's going to bring us as a lawsuit up against the judiciary themselves. We're going to sue the judiciary. If we get thrown out of this court case, we immediately go to sue the judiciary. I can only hope that we have enough money to do it because there's a lot more involved and a lot more paperwork. And we're not talking $100,000 or $20,000 or even $10,000. We're talking maybe $3,000 or $4,000. That's what it's going to take to carry this case. And maybe a little more, maybe a little less, but somewhere in that neighborhood. We could do it if people give us money for this. So I want to tell you, everybody, whether you're giving on a monthly basis or not, if this case gets thrown out, this is our leverage case to bring in before the United States Supreme Court, ultimately. The only ones we're not going to sue in the judiciary is the United States Supreme Court, depending on how they respond and who responds or if they respond to what we're going to do next. We'll wait for that to take place, for them to put the order out and to do what has to be done. And if they don't do it, then we will sue the entire judiciary, including the United States Supreme Court, for they would deserve it too. But I think the United States Supreme Court's going to do the right thing. Let's hope they do. Okay, we know that they got problems. They got guns to their head, so to speak, up there. We know that, but we also know that the deep state is going down. We also know that, and they know, I'm sure, that they have a friend in the White House now. At least the good judges, they have a friend in the White House that's going to help protect them and do what's got to be done. And so this is the best time for this kind of a situation to take place. We could not have planned this better. Now, on the other side of things, if they don't throw this case out and they permit it to go to trial, game over. They can't win. This is going to be a trial by jury. Part of the argument is going to be, oh, well, the jury can't decide law. Well, that's going to be part of the argument, and the people are going to win. We are going to win that battle. The battle of words, we will win. We have to just get it before the people. But I want to tell you, anybody who really wants to understand what's really going on in the judiciary, this case is the one that does it. We expose everything here. And this is the case that will give an education. And I suggest read from the bottom up, because the top paper is the last paper filed. Go to where we filed the papers. Read every paper from the bottom up and follow the process in a chronological fashion and try to understand this case. Read every paragraph, take your time, and make sure, you know, first read through it like a read through the paper without looking at footnotes. Just read through it for the flow to get kind of a feel for the paper. Then go back and read it and look at footnotes, because that's where the education really is in the footnotes. That's where the power and the authority is, in the footnotes. So read through a paper first, straight through, then go back and read through it, looking at the footnotes, and then move on to the next paper and do it the same way, and so on and so on. And you'll find how pitiful their position and their argument is. You'll see how obvious it is that this judge and this magistrate is hell-bent on the status quo and maintaining it, and they there's no doubt that they are planning to throw this case out. There's no doubt in my mind. Or anybody who reads the paper, you will see clearly. They are hell-bent on throwing this case out. But we may be able to stop it. First of all, with the papers we wrote, they can't respond to. Second of all, getting the United States Supreme Court involved in this. Of course, if they order it down, which they should be doing, for them to obey the law of the land and give us our court of record and open up this Article III court, then it's curtains for them. They're going to lose from the other direction. But again, we have another way to go. We never know which way we're going to go from time to time until they complete their moves. It's like a chess game. And they move in a different direction you didn't expect. Well, okay, now we're going to have to go this way instead of the way we're planning to go. We've got numerous ways to go, and I'm sure there's other things we can do as we look to see how they respond to us. Then we would discover and decide on which way to go. And there's a lot of things to do. We've had faith in doing it this way, and it has worked out. You know, again, we always left it up to God. He'll open the door, and we'll move in a direction, and we'll find ourselves going in a direction we didn't even intend on, because that's the way the chess game went, you know? That's fine. But, you know, justice is justice. Righteousness is righteousness. What is right will always prevail, and what is wrong will always eventually lose. At the end of the day, they're going to lose. And with that faith is what we took up this court case with. And we started this court case, and it's not really a court. It is a court case in a sense, because we're building towards the big court case. The court case, the place where we're filing papers is really a depository. It in itself is not a court case. But there are hundreds of cases in our case, hundreds of cases. We have non-judicial foreclosures, and we're going to use those when we go up against the judiciary. And we're going to sue the bar, too, because they're complicit with this. They're the ones who wrote the papers. But look at, we've got non-judicial foreclosures. We've got many non-judicial foreclosures across the land in different states and different counties, all doing it the same way, without giving people due process. That shows conspiracy. That shows that they've been working together, and they're always doing everything the same way. They do the same thing over and over again. Denial of habeas corpus, a clear, blatant denial of our right to be heard, our right of due process, every one of these cases. And our anticipation is to consider indictments on all of these people in the next couple of weeks, as a matter of fact. We need to start getting indictments into this case. These people that have violated these people have lost their homes, people have lost their freedom, their liberty, and sitting behind bars, and they shouldn't be there. And these people will not hear an argument, will not give these people their day in court. And so that's what this is all about. This has come to a head, and we've been building. This was our strategy from day one. Let them do what they want. That's okay. We're getting it on record. And we'll make the next move. And when they do respond, they'll only stick their foot in their mouth, and that's all they do. They constantly stick their foot in their mouth. They give us all the fodder we need. We have made them our footstools, okay? So we rest on them to respond, because we like when they respond, because we could destroy them with the truth. Light will always overtake darkness. So anyway,
I just want to learn.
Go ahead, Rod.
I just want to bring up a recent statement by, I think it was John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, and he was talking about the Second Amendment, and he said that the Second Amendment was an orphan amendment in this court, that they're unwilling to take it up, which means we got to get rid of a few other of those judges. If he's calling the Second Amendment an orphan amendment, and basically what he's saying is the lower court's rulings are standing because the Supreme Court is not taking up these Second Amendment cases because they're too hot for them right now. You know, and I don't know, you know, he was talking off the cuff. He didn't say that he believed the Second Amendment was orphaned, but what he was saying is they're unable to get the vote to hear those cases. So knowing that going forward, we should be pressuring, the people should be pressuring that court, telling them, look, if you think that's an orphan amendment, we'll be there with our guns, and you'll see how
orphan it is. Was that in an article?
Was it an article? I'm going to have to find it. We should put it in our court.
Yeah, if you
can
find it, get it to me, definitely. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, because,
I
mean, look,
it
wasn't a case, but he was talking in an interview. But the fact that he's admitting that in public, that's serious. That's some serious crap. I mean, I would just Google Second Amendment orphan case by claimed orphan case by Supreme Court Justice. I think it was Roberts, the chief judge. Anyway, that's number one. So that's something we're up against. And that's something also that we can do as NLA members and other members. We should be sending stuff to the court saying, look, we want you to hear the Second Amendment cases. And if you don't, you're gonna suffer the consequences of we the people. We should make up some kind of a some kind of a little blurb that people could send into the Supreme Court and start hitting them with this, just inundating them with it, make them afraid not to do it, right? I don't know, John, have you ever used this Constitution annotated where it says the Constitution of the United States of America analysis and interpretation, properly known as the Constitution annotated, contains legal analysis interpretation of the United States Constitution based primarily on Supreme Court case law. This is regularly updated resource, especially useful when researching the constitutional implications of a specific issue or topic.
Who put that out?
The feature, this is the court, this is congress.gov. The
This frightens me, I'll tell you why, okay? Look, I have learned a long time ago, I learned through as being a Bible teacher, and I was, was blessed to be able to learn properly at the very beginning how to look at the Bible. And the Bible clearly tells us how to look at the Bible. And this, of course, I learned very early on that we are to interpret it line upon line, precept upon precept. And I know my Bible teacher, my first Bible teacher, who was a great teacher, one of the things he always said, if you want to read commentary, read it on its own and look at it, but don't study the Bible and with commentary, because as you go on, you mix the two up and you don't even know which was the Word of God or which was commentary. And so you get very confused on that end. The other thing is if you're running down the wrong road on something and they're building upon a false foundation, you run right along with them. Now that doesn't mean you don't look and listen to other people's studies but separate it from your own study. Go into it. If you want to really understand the Constitution, the best way to understand the Constitution is go read the Federalist Papers, read the Anti-Federalist Papers, read the Declaration of Independence. I would read the Declaration of Independence. I would read the Constitution. I'd read the Bill of Rights, and I'd even read the Magna Carta. And then I would go do, and this is what I did anyway, this is how I approached it. Then I go and listen to the Federalist Papers. We do have that on audio, and we have it also in written form right on our website. And you can have the audio play and follow along in written form. That's the best way to do it. That's how I did it. And see the conversations that was brought up and then see what they ended up with at the end. And then you read the Constitution again. You see what they ended up with. And you'll come to a good understanding, lining it up, working it out logically, because common law is really ultimate logical. This is simple stuff. Look at, you do not need to be a brain surgeon or a rocket scientist to understand the Constitution. Yeah, there's some strange words there and maybe different ideas that we've never thought in those terms before. But if you take your time and work through it slowly and don't force it and continue to look, go to the next step. Sometimes it takes a while before it registers into you, and then all of a sudden, you have this deja vu, like, whoa, you have this this Helen Keller moment and an enlightening situation. And then you understand, and you go back and say, now I understand that. Because collectively, it works together, and that's the key. But I don't know if that's good or bad, but I will tell you.
Wait, let me finish. You don't let me finish. Hold on. Okay. Whoa, boy.
Ooh.
Whoa. So the next sentence is the featured topics and cases, page highlight recent U.S. Supreme Court decision that demonstrate pivotal interpretation of the Constitution's provisions. Okay. So it goes through the whole Constitution, Article 1, Article 2, Article 3. I
and
got
if it's
here
good
because
you're American jurisprudence, that's good,
Well, listen to this. I want to get to the end of this. You wanted to know if they could fire judges and that, what the rule was and that. So I ended up here.
Give me a copy of this too. I'd like to read this.
You got to read this. This is yep. Amazing because it goes to Article 3 is they pull the judicial power of the courts and the judges, and they spell it out. But I see they even talk about the patent office and the trademark cases and blah blah. But then they get into, and they were talking about the judges. First, they talk about the judges that have a lifetime tenure, and how Congress can create courts, which implies that they can negate them. They said, but they made a problem. This is way back in Jefferson. This is back in the beginning of the country. they decided to get rid of the Commerce Course. They said, but what are we going to do with these judges that have a lifetime tenure, and now we're getting rid of their court? So they were in a conundrum with that. And then eventually it went all the way up to 1900 before where the court finally got rid of the Commercial Court, which people weren't very happy with and wasn't making good decisions. And what they did was they got rid of it, and they put its powers into the other district courts, and they spread those judges amongst those courts. So they didn't have to fire them because the Constitution says you can't fire them, unless they're committing treason or something. But the point I want to get to is they talk about legislative courts. And I want to read this because I think it bodes into why we are where we are and the game that's being played. And they're very careful to not violate the Constitution as written. But they don't mind playing around in the powers that – the Congress and the judiciary lots of open-ended stuff, lots of open-ended powers. They expected us to go in there and fix it. And they did. They did, and they fixed it for themselves, basically. But not all bad stuff. But if you don't know where it came from or how they're using it, you won't know to protest, to bring yourself back into. These words are pretty powerful here, though, I think. So anyway, they talk about – I'm going to read it because I don't know how else to do it. It says the legislative courts are so-called because they are created by Congress pursuant to its general legislative powers and have comprised a significant part of the federal judiciary. The distinction between the constitutional courts and legislative courts was first made in American Insurance Company versus Cantor, which involved the question of the admiralty jurisdiction of the Territorial Court of Florida, the judges of which were limited to 4-year term, blah, blah, Chief Justices Marshall wrote for the court. These courts then are not constitutional courts in which the judicial power conferred upon by the Constitution on the general government can be deposited. They are incapable of receiving it. They are legislative courts created in virtue of the general right of sovereignty which exists in the government, and there's lots of footnotes here, I'm not reading them, in the virtue that the clause which enables Congress to make all needful rules and regulation respecting the territory belonging to the United States, some words here you need to pay attention to, the jurisdiction in which they are vested is not part of that judicial power which is defined in the third article of the Constitution, but is conferred by Congress in the execution of these general powers which that body possesses over the territories of the United States. The court went on to hold that admiralty jurisdiction can be exercised in the states only by those courts that are established pursuant to Article 3, but that the same limitation does not apply to the territorial courts for the legislating for them. Congress exercises the combined powers of the general and the state government. So
I disagree. I don't see any constitutional authority to give them the ability to apply the law of the sea on the law of the land at all.
No,
I know they're
saying that. He's saying that they don't have constitutional power.
Right. There is no authority.
So
they refer back to Article 1, and they call it, I've heard it called only by a few people, Article 1 courts. There's no such thing as an Article 1 court. Okay. And, they're referring to the fact that Congress has the authority, is vested with the power and the authority to create tribunals. Okay. And the tribunals ultimately are talking about the judges. Okay. Given the putting the judges into power. Okay. But the court itself, the jurisdiction of the court is found in Article 3, okay? So, what is their jurisdiction? And what court? There's only two courts, if you want to separate, and they're not separated per se. You don't call them different courts. It's the court, a court of justice, period, where either law or equity is in view. And equity is chosen by the individual going into the court as the plaintiff chooses the jurisdiction, and maybe they want the equity court, so they choose that jurisdiction. I would imagine that the other side could object to it if they object early enough. Of course, it has to be objected early enough, but they can object to an equity court and say, no, I want a court of law. In other words, I want a jury. But equity courts are great as long as the judges are obedient to American jurisprudence. They're honorable, and they're maintaining, they're keeping their oath, and they're doing the right thing. equity courts are finding, because there is a process that you can appeal to, an appellate process, okay? But when you go into a court where there's a jury, that is final. But that's good, too, but it takes longer.
They can't do an admiralty court if there's no contract, is the point. It doesn't go.
Well, they can't even do it if, you know, look at, again, what kind of contract could possibly bring you into, did you say equity or did you say admiralty?
Admiralty.
Okay, admiralty. No, admiralty court, that deals with issues at sea. And when it's brought onto the land, it's, for instance, you know, the idea is, you know, you catch some pirates out at sea, you capture their ship, they flee, they get away, or they get killed, or whatever the case may be, but you got their ship, you tow it into port. And now when you tow it into port, you file your proof of claim, you file fiduciary authority over that ship. Now, if the pirates want to come over and get due process, of course, they'll get arrested, I'm sure. You know, say, hey, that's my ship, you know. I want it back. Well, yeah, well, we're going to put you in jail. We'll give it back at the end or whatever. The thing is they're not going to come. So they made a process called in rem to go after things that belong to other people, but you could do it by seizing it, claiming proof, put a proof of claim on it, calling it a pirate ship and whatever the report was, claiming the fiduciary authority over that, getting that through the courts, and then if necessary, the court, basically I would believe the court would just rubber stamp it all the way through. It's a process and procedure, and then you take ownership of the ship. If there is a conflict, then the opportunity to argue it in court exists. And there's other cases, of course, but I'm given one of the most extreme cases on how this thing kind of works. But so it is fought on the land, but it's an issue at sea. If it's not an issue at sea, you can't bring admiralty court onto the land, and that is what they've done. But it's worse than that. They've brought courts with jurisdictions totally unknown. We really don't know the jurisdictions that they're in. We have no clue. And they make it up as they go, and they even change their own rules and change statutes and the meaning thereof. So who knows where we're at with these people when you go into their courts. Again, the big battle we've always found is you got to fight with the judge before you can even fight the case. And it's always the same issue over and over and over again. And we hear other plaintiffs saying the same thing constantly, same issue,
well,
over and over again.
Basically, what they're saying here, from what I can see, is that those courts are completely controlled by Congress. They don't have the restrictions on them that the Article III courts do, and that even the president at some point can fire those judges in the tax courts and the other they could be.
Yeah, but
removed.
Those are Article III courts also.
They are, but they're explaining the difference of them where the original Article III courts that they set up, the judges are for life, you can't fire them, and they do those constitutional things. These other courts that Congress set up from time to time, these legislative courts, they don't have the restriction on them. Congress can close them, open them, fire them, which is a good thing because you don't
them
to have unfettered.
Absolutely.
So that's what they're talking about here. And he does mention an Article I court, and he said, even though they're not supposed to be, he said, I could show you where they're using an Article I court. We need to read this anyway because
yeah,
this
but
comes
Article
out.
One court. I can tell you, I looked into this court, this thing. Article One court does not exist. It's in the mind of idiots, in my opinion, because how they get that language, how they create an Article One court out of Article One, which I believe is found in Section 8 or 9. I think it's in 8, where it goes through the authorities. You know, the power, the congressional powers that we've given. I'll have to look to see where it's at. But
well,
they don't.
About, I'm coming out of the mind of some judge here.
Yes, it's insane. It doesn't make
Justice
any sense at all.
White apparently believes them to be Justice White. You know?
Look at Article 3, the beginning of it says the judicial powers of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, period. And it goes on in other such inferior courts as Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. And we're up to 94 of them, so at least 94 different districts, okay? There are many courts inside each district, way too many in my opinion. I don't see any reason to have any more than one in every federal district. If we get rid of all the nonsense, get rid of all the administrative processes, bring us back to constitutional courts, there'll be no need to really have much things going on in the federal courts that we would need so many courts as we have. Now, of course, distance is a problem, you know. That's understood. So I think the 94 districts is good. But once you get into a district, like, for instance, the Northern District here, I think we have four different locations of Northern District Courts, don't we? We got quite a few different locations, I believe. But we don't need all that. We just need one court every so, you know, 94 district courts is fine. Don't need any more.
Looks like that. It looks like the reason they came up with that fiction of the Article One is they're attempting to create a court that's not, that Congress and the president, you know, these other courts, these inferior courts, they're making an inferior court of that they're trying to remove from the oversight of Congress and the president.
Right. It's called subversion.
By saying Article One, because Article Three. They can't close that court, and they can't fire those judges. It's right in the Constitution. But these other courts, it says, hey, they can do whatever they deem necessary. They're inferior courts. So if people don't understand how they're moving them and why they're moving, I mean, reading this makes me understand that they're playing this game, this dancing game between you know, an Article III court and admiralty and equity and all this crap. And so they feel comfortable doing what they're doing because they got all this gobbledygook going on, and you answer them, and it gives, and they feel like they got jurisdiction over you.
Well, if you want to understand the structure and how these judges are appointed and how long they're there for and how they are taking out, so to speak, and so on and so forth, which is really a fulfillment of a term. And, you know, people should read the Judiciary Act of 1789, because the Judiciary Act of 1789 is very good. And it lays out the process of exactly what we're talking about right now. But the problem with the Judiciary Act of 1789 is that's when they stuck in there this kind of an equity court that is really under chancery and runs under the rules of chancery, ultimately. You see, that was the first thing, that they proceed according to the rules of chancery, right there. That's all they had to say, one little seed, and that seed's going to grow. And as they move on, it grows and grows and grows. We have all of these acts of Congress where the enemy is there covertly putting all this information in, a piece here, a piece there. It's called constructive law. You don't see the whole picture until you look at all of the different acts, and you look at, oh, here's one here, and here's something here that shouldn't have been there. You see these covert acts, then you put these covert acts together, and then you see the big picture. We're in a constructive prison. A statutory prison is what they've created for us. We the people are the enemy, okay, in the Trading of the Enemy Act, okay? And again, it's covertly put in there. It's legalese. And now they work this idea with an Article One court that's just a seed to be put, and if the people bite on it and they buy it, the next thing you know they're creating these Article One courts, and they will overtake an Article Three court. But an Article One court doesn't even exist. It makes no sense. Again, you know, the simplicity of the Constitution makes it quite clear, in my opinion, in Article Three, where it says the judicial power of the United States shall be invested in one Supreme
Court. Are you there? I think we lost him. Or did I lose me?
I dropped out. Huh?
Yeah, you dropped out.
Okay. I think I'm back in.
Well,
anyway.
They got one last paragraph in this thing that really sums up what you just said. I'm going to read it and then I'm going to rest because it's been long enough. It says,
yeah, how big is this an article or a book?
Oh, no, this is the Constitution annotated. It's 800 and something pages. I'm just on Article 3,
okay.
Which I don't know how many pages that is.
No,
I should just give it to you.
You get me, I mean, get whatever you can. Is this an electronic copy or
yeah, it's
physical?
A PDF. I'll send it to you. It's a
PDF.
Yeah,
drop it in my Skype. I'll take a look at it.
And they talk about mixing this Article One court, and as long as it's under the essential attributes of decisions must remain in the Article Three court, but so long as it does, Congress may use administrative decision makers in those private right cases that arise in the context of comprehensive federal statutory scheme. So you see, this is how they're bringing their statutes in, and they're claiming that it hasn't Article 3 oversight, but meanwhile, does it really, you know?
Yeah. Well, look, here's what I find disturbing and a problem. The Constitution is so simple and so minimum. That's common law. Our founding fathers put it together this way, very, very simple. And the Constitution ultimately declares our agreement with God, our covenant with God, and that we're under common law, and that we made that covenant with God, therefore, and then we, through that power and authority of liberty given to us by God, wrote a constitution, created a republic through that constitution, making that constitution the law of the land, which covers, of course, law and equity as the law of the land, okay? Equity under jurisprudence, in this case, American jurisprudence, okay? And the constitution in itself is controls our all three branches of government, and it lays it out very, and it's so simple. And if you need 800 pages to explain that, I think that's a problem. You can give lessons and you can teach on this thing and you can connect things and line upon line and bring it together, but
Article 3 is 268 pages long. Article 3.
Yeah, I that's the one I'll read. I like to. Yeah, give me a copy. I'll take a look at it. And maybe I can comment better. Maybe it's a good book. I don't know. You know,
I tend to believe that. No, and I think if you read it, it becomes more clear. And after going through these court cases and what they're doing to us, it makes more sense to me of where their mind is, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And why they're doing it. And that means that, look, we should be able to articulate better along their languages when we know what scheme they're using that makes them feel so good about violating us in this 800 pages of gobbledygook here.
Yeah. Well, let me take a look, and I'll give you my thoughts more on that.
Yeah, I'll put it in your box and see. Yep.
Nice.
All right, I'll shut up now.
We ready to move on? Okay. We're going to go to Brent in a short while. I'm sorry holding you up so long, Brent, but I do want to go to Crystal because she's got a unique problem. She's about ready to lose a home. We just did a non-judicial foreclosure paper for her, and that went in the mail today. Crystal, let me unmute her, and then she'll talk about the situation a little bit, and maybe I can give some ideas. Crystal, try to see if you can get the mic going. We got
Hi,
you.
How
go
you
right
doing?
Ahead. Good.
Okay, yes. Okay, well, we had quite a few. I had a wonderful turnout and wonderful support this morning in the court. They're pre-planning. They're stealing people's homes, changing people's mortgages, and everybody definitely better check your mortgage deeds and stuff. Two people had their mortgages changed on them a year and a half ago. One went to get his tax return, and his accountant told him, he goes, well, you don't own the house. This company owns your house. And they said, you abandoned your house. This man has his warranty deed. His house is paid for. He's still in his house. So they're taking people's homes and clusters. And so when he called me up today, he said, okay, you got 10 minutes to talk. And when I got up there, he goes, now you only got 5 minutes. I said, yes, you just said I had 10 minutes. He goes, well, you got 5 minutes and the attorney has 5 minutes. You think you're going to waste this whole time on you for your long case? And I said, I swear myself in, first of all. I said, I swear the truth, whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me, Jehovah God, Jesus Christ. And he goes, get on with it. Then because he had asked my name, I then said, I asked you to recuse yourself from my case. I said, this is mortgage fraud. I have my warranty deed. I have a quick claim deed with life use of 100 years. And the remaining owner whom I look to put 500 years in trust. He goes, I don't care what you have. He goes, you had your life use of it. And he goes, and we're still taking your house. And it's going to be auctioned off on Saturday. I said, well, who's going to sign my name off, Your Honor? He goes, well, you owe the other people. He said, you owe GE Credit Union. I said, I do not owe them nothing. I said, I've been coming here for over 4.5 years, Your Honor, and I've been asking you for proof of claim. I asked you for a sworn notarized affidavit. I sent you the subrogation, and no one has yet answered me anything. I said, and you also defaulted, and I asked you repeatedly to discharge the case. And I said, and I asked you about the common law jury. Oh, and by the way, Your Honor, anything over $20, I can have a common law jury. That's under my constitutional rights. He said, well, under the Connecticut law, there is no rights. He goes, the only ones who have a jury is a criminal case or like a malpractice or whatever, you know, some big top case. I said, well, Your Honor, losing your homes and the homes in Connecticut, everything is going through the roof. I said, Connecticut's the new Hollywood, and the homes are starting to sell for $1 million. And I said, and by the way, in 2003, my property was appraised at $260,000, and you got me way below the level. He goes, well, that's tough. Those are our rules. I said, but you are violating my constitutional rights. And he goes, and I said, also, I would like you to recuse yourself again, Your Honor, because, you know, you told me when you went to the court, you were called in the court, and you said that the judge said, don't worry about her. We're going to dismiss all her cases. I said, that's definitely conflict of interest. And he had mentioned, he goes, yeah, and then you had another case up in Albany, New York. And he goes, and that was the one they threw out. So there is no case against me. So I'm moving forward. I said, but you are acting biased. I said, you're prejudiced. I said, you're abusing your power. And I said, and this is unconstitutional. I said, again, Your Honor, I would like a common law grand jury, and I would like for you to recuse yourself from my case. I said, you have committed treason, because how are you making the laws and then breaking the laws? I said, you also, the treason, because I, you know, and there was a few other things. But he goes, are you finished? He goes, well, that's too bad. Saturday, your house has got to be gone. I said, well, who's going to sign my name off my property when I have my warranty deed and my quitclaim? He goes, that's no problem. That will be taken care of. Well, now they're messing with legal documents. You know, I'm just saying to myself. And what was the other thing? He said the case in Albany, New York, was thrown out. And the case here in Bridgeport was also thrown out. But there's a lot, I found out there's a lot of grievances on this judge and also the attorneys. And I guess, as a matter of fact, I was unaware of it. I just found out a little while ago they had a big meeting on these same attorneys that worked with this judge down at City Hall. So I'll find out the outcome, what happened tomorrow. Because everybody, I guess, wants to file criminal charges and feel what their right is. So I've been telling everybody, I gave them the number to National Liberty Alliance. And we all have to be court observers and stuff. But it's the same, and he's showing up over and over. The man needs to be under the jail. He must take about 1,000 homes a week. It's a nightmare what this man is doing, and he could care less. It's just horrifying.
Well, no doubt. It is RICO, and it's a plague across America, everywhere. So... okay, well, let's talk a little bit about what you might be able to do. And,
this is the last thing before you go any further. I did file an appeal this evening before I left the court and to the appellate court. It was stamped in at about 5:05, and by the time I got to my car, friend called and he said, oh, they already stamped it, but they said they're going to change your foreclosure date to June 4th. That quick, they, you know, they are constantly scheming. I just got the letter tonight for the decision that he was supposed to give me when he scanned, when he got the copies of my mortgage, I mean the mortgage release and all that. I just got that today, and that was from the 16th of May. So you see what they're doing. It's just a nightmare what they're doing to people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Well, you know, people who are filing the nonjudicial foreclosure papers that we put out for them, and then we serve it on the judge, we serve it on the individuals that's trying to foreclose, whether it's a mortgage company or maybe a tax foreclosure. And so we serve it on the judge. And if there's no judge's name, then we serve it upon the chief judge in that court. We've compiled quite a few of these things, and we're still sending them out. We're still compiling them. And we're going to go talking to the grand jury hopefully in the next few weeks to a month at the most. I think we're ready to get together to make a decision on this ask for an indictment. I'm sure we'll get one, but we're going to ask the grand jury for an indictment concerning all these judges that are doing these nonjudicial foreclosures. All of these companies, you know, mortgage companies, or whoever, you know, is responsible on the county level with the taxes, okay, and we're going to indict them. We're going to bring them up to the grand jury for indictment, and if we get an indictment, and again, I'm pretty sure we will, then we'll place those indictments into our depository. You know, these judges. They check to see the case. They see the case. Ah, the judge threw it out. He closed it down, so on and so forth. No, they're still taking papers, and we're still filing, and it never was to be a court case. Never, ever, ever, ever intended this case to be anything but a depository and a place to put our papers, a place to be under the auspices of the court, that they are aware of us, what we're doing, and reading our papers. Whether they like it or not is irrelevant. So this is all part of our court case that we are going to file against the judiciary very soon, hopefully. But we'll see. Again, it's a chess game. We've got to see what moves they're going to make before we make our next move. So we'll take it from there. Now, what people can do.
Our federal case is not dismissed?
Oh, absolutely. Well, look, there never was a case to dismiss. We had to go through the process in order to get the papers into the court, okay? But we never, ever, you know, intended on really going through. We intended on filing, you know, whatever kind of an indictment we might file, file all of our papers that we sent across the nation over a year. We were sending papers out. We sent papers, you know, to everyone in government on the federal level and on the state levels, all the governors, the houses of representatives in the states, the U.S. Congress, the U.S. Senate. Everyone and all the judges that you had, all the federal judges and the state judges on the state level and so on. So, and all of this information, all of these papers, we needed a place to file them, and they didn't want to work with We the People because they know that that's the end of their RICO game that they got going here. So we opened up a case for the sole purpose of depositing all of our paperwork, and they're still taking it. And that's fine. They can call it whatever they want. We're under the auspices of the court. Now, we also file all of our paperwork again with you know, Jeff Sessions. He gets a copy of everything we've done. And also Senator Grassley with the Judiciary Committee. He gets a copy of everything we've done, and the President of the United States. And now we're going to bring in the United States Supreme Court. And we're going to start filing with them now. Okay, let's see. Again, we're going to open up another case soon and sue the judiciary. But anyway, going back to one way to protect your property is to get into this kind of a situation. That's one possibility. The key thing you want to do, though, if they come to take your property away in a nonjudicial foreclosure, and there's no other way they can do it, by the way. That's why they formulated this nonjudicial foreclosure. Okay, so the thing you could do is take it into federal court for cause. And the cause is the violation of your due process. Now, you have to be very careful on how you move something in for cause. I'm trying to think if we have a good example up on our website. I know we've got stuff in there for cause, but I'm going to have to put something out there so people can kind of look at, you know, and kind of, you know, copy. We've got lots of memorandums, and if some of these memorandums fit your case, take the memorandum, design them around your case, and use them. But the key thing is getting into the court and into the federal court. And you're not going to argue your case. If you're going to go in there and argue your case, they're going to throw you out because they don't have the jurisdiction over your case. They have the jurisdiction. You're moving in for cause, and the cause has got to be a violation of one of your unalienable rights. And the right that they're violating is the right of due process. So that's your cause. You can use some U.S. Codes under 42 and 18 where they're acting under the color of law. This is written, this is good law, written to control them. And there are jail sentences that are suggested, can't be permanent, you know, the jury will decide, but there are jail sentences suggested for these people who are acting under the color of law and violating your rights, claiming to be an authority and the right to do it under the law. That's operating under the color of law. So you'll want to use those quotes also. The big problem you have is you're going into a civil court. The civil court is a statutory court. You need to understand that. That creates another problem. But, you know, they're very careful in these courts, and you don't want to get into big arguments on anything other than the fact that you're in there for. And your wherefore clause must end up with being for them to cease and desist from all actions against you and also to restore you to your original state prior to the beginning of their assault upon you by using the court systems. Okay? So whatever your injury is, you're looking for that. Okay, but the most important thing you look in is for them to cease and desist. Once the order goes down, if you win in a federal court, and if you're very careful, you could win in a federal court. And when it goes down, the bottom line, they have to cease and desist. That means they got to throw it out, and they can't pursue you again anymore. They can't come out after you for your house. Now, the way you win in a federal court, ultimately, is to challenge any of their authorities. They're not giving you due process. They have no proof of anything on your property or anything of that nature. So you don't have to worry about that, but you don't want to get into those arguments. The key thing is your due process is being violated in a court that there is no judicial process. It's just a procedure. And most people lose their homes. They leave their homes. And, you know, the mortgage company or the tax people will deliver a paper to them and tell them they got to leave, that they take their seats in the house, and they'll give them to a certain date. And there's no power or authority to do anything. The courts haven't moved to be able to give them the power or no paperwork to do anything. They can't use the sheriff. They might send a server. And I heard recently they've sent the sheriff out in one case to serve the summons, which was a summons. And not a dispossess, but they're using the sheriff to also continue their crime. But in any event, they can't do anything to just throw you out without going through some kind of a process and a procedure. So what they do is they'll serve your papers. Most people, a large percentage of the people, will think they have to leave. I know someone recently who thought they had to leave. I told them they didn't, but they believed these people more than me, and they left. So they abandoned the house, okay? Now they're able to seize it because it's been abandoned, and it's a very easy process. Might take a year or two, but it's a regular legal process they go through. Now, if you don't leave, they go through a legal process anyway, and they legally change the title, they change the information, they take ownership, and then eventually, that takes a couple of years, it goes through the process. And all of this is part of the non-judicial foreclosure process. Then they get to a point where they make a claim in the court of ownership of the house. The judge will then give the order, if it has to be, for the dispossessed. Usually they'll seek the dispossession through calling you a tenant, and they're the landlords. After all, the name on the deed is now no longer yours, it's them, and then they take your house. And that's how they accomplish this, and they do it over and over and over again. And then your house is moved into, they monetize these mortgages. They package them up and they sell them to each other. A lot of lawyers, they set their retirements up in these things. And they have this constant income coming through, this constant turnover of house, of mortgage monies mm-hmm. coming through.
Yep.
And then they do the same thing to the next person, and over mm-hmm. and over and over again. It is RICO on steroids. So, but it's a very simple process in the federal courts if you're very careful. And again, how to write a paper, the best way to do it is reading. Okay, read. You know, if you want to understand some good law, read some good cases. You know, Marbury versus Madison, a great case. What I would do before reading Marbury versus Madison is read the Judiciary Act of 1789, then read Marbury versus Madison. And there's a lot of great cases. You know, of course, U.S. versus Williams is one that gives us a lot of power and authority, gives us a lot of knowledge. Knowledge is power. But read the cases that we have. Understand how to write a paper. Look for the language. Look for the footnotes. Use footnotes. Explain the meanings of these things. It may take you time to write your papers and put them together, but you need to take your time to write your papers and put them together. And create your defense. And again, you don't want to get lost in the court about anything. They may come into the court and start talking about things that has nothing to do with the case. Okay? Don't get sucked into that. We're not here to discuss that, Your Honor. We're here to discuss their abuse of me, and they've abused me and denied me my right of due process. That's what we're here for. That's what this case is about. Stay on point. Don't let it get watered down. But it should run through pretty quickly if you do good paperwork and you send it in. You might have one hearing, and there's a good chance you could win in the federal courts that way. As long as you really tighten up on your paperwork and keep it focused on the violation of your right of due process. All right,
and did you receive those affidavits?
I did receive a bunch of things, but I don't know. I didn't look at them today in my – was it the email? I think
yes,
your friend sent me.
Yeah,
I got the paperwork from Jim. Jim sent me all the paperwork, and we filed your papers today. That went out, but I didn't look at anything else yet.
So, it went out to the court.
Yeah, it went out to the court. You'll get a copy probably the day after tomorrow, and you'll know that the court got it at the same time. So I don't know. Maybe you'll get it tomorrow. It went out I don't know. It's possible, I guess. Well, Long Island, I'm sure it's going to take 2 or 3 days. No, you're in Connecticut. Yeah, it mm-hmm. might take 2 days, maybe 3 at the most.
Yeah, and
but Mr. GE got
judge.
It. Went after Mr. GE and the judge, and then we sent you a copy. And then, of course, we filed
the
copy. In the, well, we filed the copy. No, we went after filed it to the judge. We only go after the individuals that, and keeping it simple. So we go after, the mortgage company or the tax collector, one or the other, who's taking the property, and then the judge. And those are the two.
And it's the attorneys that are taking the property.
Yeah, I understand that, but we're not focusing in on them at this moment. We can't get too involved with all this. And remember, it becomes too complex. Here's the problem.
Okay.
The judge knows what he's doing, and he's stealing your property and giving it. He's kowtowing to the status quo. He's giving it to the mortgage company. There's a game here because it's the banks. Mortgage companies are very connected to the banks. The whole thing is together, and that's who they serve. They serve the banksters, So the judge is the key to the individual that violated his oath, and then the individual is coming in with the fraud, bringing it to the judge and colluding with the judge. That's the other side of the coin. So we go after those two, keeping it simple. And then once it gets into your case is making it to the point where we're going to be asking for indictments in the next few weeks, hopefully, definitely within the next month. And then we will file the indictments in the court, And then you can show him a copy of his indictment with his name on it. And it doesn't matter that it's a court case that he thinks is closed, but they're still taking our paperwork. It's a depository, and we keep a copy up on our website. And the Judiciary Committee has it, and Jeff Sessions has it, and the President has it, and the New York Supreme Court's going to get the whole thing soon.
Oh, so, that's wonderful.
That's where we're at.
Yeah, and that's what I told the people. I said, don't move out your house. Stay there. You know, and that's that. Then they told me they want the keys to my house to come in. They're not coming to my house, and I'm not giving you no keys to my house. And
I'd be very surprised if this judge signs a piece of paper in some way, you know, because usually they just go, well, hold it. They have changed the names on the title. Have they done that?
No. I have the warranty deed. I have the quick claim deed. I have the life use. I have everything. I hear
you
that
don't have a sheriff
trying
out
to change.
There,
no.
No. But yeah. I did go to the police department and see, I brought the proof to the police department and I said, please, I said, you are here just as a witness. Please do not sit there and assess or, you know, say, give your opinion on it because you will be held accountable for it. I said the executive order that President Trump signed off December 21st, 2017. Well, this cop wrote the papers up and said, I find nothing wrong with it. I said, look here, I don't even want you to get in no kind of trouble. I didn't ask you to give your opinion on this. You're really clueless on what you... I said, I gave you all the information, and he just took some notes. I said, you have to understand. I said, this is the work I used to do, you know. So I said, just write the facts. As a matter of fact, make the copy. So I can do it like 1 through 10 so you'll understand, you know. But again, they, you know, nobody can't tell them nothing. So that's that, you know. So I got to go there and pick that up tomorrow also.
All right, well, hopefully all things will work out. And, you know, again, move into the federal court quickly. You got to move into the federal court quickly on this. And you know what? Why don't you you got to type this up and get it connected to me through, you know, through somebody that has email or whatever, and get this information to me before you put it in. And I'll go through your paperwork and help kind of perfect your paperwork. And then once that's perfected and you use that paperwork, we'll post it up on our site so that other people having your problem, they'll kind of see the paperwork and how to do it. But again, if you anybody that's going to do this, look it. Don't think you're just going to have one paper. You're going to copy a paper. You're going to walk into the court and you're going to have success. You could have success that simple, but the bottom line is you have to understand what you're doing and you should educate yourself. Because if it happened to you today, it can happen again tomorrow. And if it happened to you, to your neighbor, it can happen to you tomorrow. But the thing is read all these cases. Read our cases because it's an education. Read we have some very powerful Supreme Court ruling cases. Read them. Read those cases. Very, very powerful. Read our footnotes and then look into other cases that you'll see under our footnotes. You just Google them and you'll just cut and paste the name and the numbers, throw it into Google, and these cases will jump up on you, download them in PDF, and read them, okay? This is how you educate yourself. The best education is reading. Read, 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 read.
Yep.
Done.
Definitely. And there's an investigation with the credit union, NUCA. And so I send them all the documents, too. And I have to send those other papers off. But I'm just plugging in everything possible. And the federal court told me I cannot file back with them again.
Well, you can't file the way you filed, maybe. Why don't you send me what you filed? Okay, let me take a look at that. And you can't file – how did you file the case? You filed the case trying to move the argument of what's going on down here up there?
Well, I filed the complaint against this judge, you know,
in the federal
court.
Yeah, they're not going to hear it. Look, they're very, very strict in the federal court. They do not want to hear any cases coming in by any plaintiff, especially a pro se person. They don't want to hear it unless if they have any way that they can kind of hang their hat out on and say we can kick this case out and not listen to it or look at it or anything, they're going to do that. And that's what they've done to you. They're not going to look at these cases. You have to be very specific and focused, and your case has to be built around a violation of an unalienable right, okay? That's what the case must be built around. They will tell you that you'll have to have a federal code, and that's okay. You're going to stick the code in there, and the code you stick in, you know, again, I'll help you out with those codes. But let's write a good paper, okay? You write your paper up the way you think you need to do it, get it to me, and then I will kind of knit it together for you and give it back to you, and we'll work it back and forth to make sure we got everything, all the facts accurate. But we want to stay focused on what this case is about. Due process. It's not about them changing your property's names and coming and taking your property. It has nothing to do with any of those things. It's very simple. Due process. Your Honor, if they want to take my home and they think they could do it, let Mr. GE go file a complaint at the court and let's go battle it out. And he's not going to win. Okay? So since they can't win, they got to come out after me with these non-judicial foreclosures, which means they're not giving me my due process in a court of justice, and that's why we're here. They violated my right of due process. You always got to stay on point, on point, on point. Nothing else matters, but that's the only thing that court is going to rule on, and your wherefore clause is going to say cease and desist. So at the end of the day, the order will come out if you win in the court to cease and desist. You may discover, okay, and this is probably, if you're going to win, this is probably how it's going to happen. The judge is going to turn, as long as you got a nice tight case, okay, but they are getting bolder, so, you know, but as long as you got a nice, but also the deep state's going down, the federal judges know that. They should, well, these judges up in Albany don't know it yet. But anyway, look at, they don't want the case to be a win on the record. Okay, it's the last thing they want. This judge cannot have that. Okay, and I can picture the judge doing what he's done in my case, going to the other side and say, make this case go away. Okay, and then they cease and desist and serve all the papers and everything just falls apart and they leave you alone. And you just got to make sure that the paper is really tight that they offer you, you know. And then that's it. And then they go away. And then the court case falls away. Don't push it any further. If you win through an agreement, take the win and walk away. Don't push it because you're not going to win on the other side. The judge is going to be stuck. He can't permit a case to come through like this to be won in his court, at least not yet. Okay?
Okay, so you don't pursue it then.
Right. If they let you off the hook and give you everything back and leave you alone, as long as the paperwork is nice and tight, and you feel confident with that, walk. That's
okay.
Fine.
But they would have to give you back all that I lost out of this. So.
Well, you may not get that, but you can push for that and you can go through the process of negotiating all that, and that's what you want. Stay strong in the negotiation. Remember, if they're negotiating with you, they're only negotiating because of one reason. Because the judge told them to. That's why they're negotiating. And that's stress on them, because they know that judge now is going to get really pissed off at them, number one, and they don't know how he's going to rule now. They've got to think, I'm sure, that he's going to rule for you and not them. Okay? He doesn't want to have to do that. Okay? He just doesn't want to do that.
Okay. All right.
So take advantage of the negotiation. Get as much as you can. But when you find that you can't get any further, as long as you're saving your house, that's your key thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you can go back and sue them. Look, you can sue them later on when we get courts of justice. I don't know that we're really that far away from it. With what's going on in Washington and what we're doing and where we're heading to and our, you know, we're coming to a head here at National Liberty Alliance with the grand jury and the courts. We're coming to a head. And
we
and
got
once
about
we file that,
people to sign up down here.
Okay, great.
So, I mean, we got a lot of good, knowledgeable people. We got a lady that worked in the courts for 22 years. We got people that worked in the bank. So, I tell you, it's a good, strong group we have going on. And all right. You're meeting all the people right there in the court. Thank you.
Okay, Crystal, we're going to move on. Let me mute you right now. Anybody else who wants to get into the queue, star six. But we're going to move over to Brent for a short while, and he's going to talk with us. And then we'll go into an open forum if anybody has any questions or comments, and then we'll open the open forum. Gerard, you going to take over the panel once we introduce Brent? You got to unmute your mic, though. Gerard? Calling Gerard. Unmute your mic. All right. Well, anyway, we'll move forward. Brent, we're going to open up now for Brent. Brent is the author of The Excellence in the Common Law, and his website is commonlawyer.com. So let's take it from there. Brent, you got the mic.
Thank you, John. Again, my comments may or may not be exactly what Liberty Alliance would say or the position they would take. They're mine comments and mine alone, but I am thankful for the opportunity to make them. Boy, this has been a stimulating conversation, especially a discussion about Article 1, 3 courts, Article 3 courts, Article 1 courts, all the different courts, the non-article courts. Of course, the point I got out of the discussion was, number one, this is woeful confusion the way it's presented. That's a fact. There's no sense in all this. I've been hearing this stuff for decades. I'm so weary of it, and it's not the patriot community that's doing it. Oh, they're doing it, but they're not the only ones. The courts are doing it. The political commentators are caught up into this 1-3-1-3-3-1 court bit business. And they're buzzwords in politics. They make people mad, and they don't even know what they're mad about. I like to use the example of stem cell research. You mentioned there was a time when you mentioned stem cell research, and people would start pulling guns and drawing daggers. You'd ask any one of them, what is stem cell research? And I couldn't, personally, didn't find anybody that could really describe what it was. I didn't know, really, either. But I didn't want to get caught up in the hype until I understood, and I didn't have time to understand it at that time. Well, that's the way it is with this Article 1, Article 3 court discussion. So as the discussion was going on, I'm thinking, how can I express this? That's what I look for, ways to express truth that's understandable. Let me try another one. I'll try it on you, and if it works, let me know. The Constitution of the United States only creates just three offices. These and no others, these and no more. He creates the office we call the President of the United States, the presidency. He creates the office we call congressman, that's number two. Senators and representatives, those are congressmen. He creates that office. And it creates one other office. And presently, there are nine of them, but our Constitution doesn't say there has to be nine. There was a time when there were only three. It's kind of the custom now, the common law custom of nine. I believe England has 12. But our Constitution creates this office. It's called the Supreme Court Justices of the United States. Our Constitution creates only the Supreme Court of the United States, no other courts. The presidency, the office of presidency, the office of congressman, and the offices called Supreme Court justices. That's it. Three branches of government, three offices. But it describes in detail how they are to be chosen and put in place. It's how. It's a document that stresses how things are to be done, how government is supposed to do it. That's our common law. The law of the city stresses what is to be done. We must do the will of the state. That's the fundamental difference. But back to the three offices. So the three offices are created. Our Constitution creates them. It is the constitutional trunk of the constitutional tree rooted in the people of the United States. The people, key phrase. Well, out of that trunk grows these three branches, separately and independently. Neither one of them depend upon the other, but depending upon the trunk of the tree, which we call the Constitution of the United States. By the way, you could look at it this way, too. That tree called the Constitution of the United States is rooted in the land. Why? Because it's the law of the land. I have people call me, and they're in court, and they're putting forth their arguments about what they're going to say when the judge tries to do this or that. And they say, we're going to tell the judge that we're not subject to the laws of this state. I didn't submit myself to the laws of this state by my consent. And my answer is that our common law is the law of the land. It's rooted in the land. Raw territoriality is powerful because it's about land. And everything within the territory of the state is subject, is a potential subject of the law of that state. It depends upon what comes up, but the courts will take jurisdiction in a lot of cases, and rightly so. Why? Because it's the law of the land. Well, there are a lot of bad things about our government, but let's stick to the good things and stress them because they're forgotten. Well, there are three offices that are created. And of those three offices, then, our Constitution gives those people in those offices, those three offices our Constitution has created, those three offices we call creatures. Why? Because they're created. Creatures of our Constitution. And then our Constitution delegates authority to these three offices, congressmen, presidents, and Supreme Court justices. And it delegates authority to them, and it tells us how it is to be done. These men filling these three offices are to appoint in place other officers of government under them. Very precise our Constitution is about it, but very simple. For instance, it says that the Congress of the United States, Article 1 is about Congress, Article 2 is about the presidency, Article 3 is about that other office called the Supreme Court justices. But in Article 1, it says that Congress, these are creatures of the Constitution, limbs, as it were, of the branches of government, Congress has the power to appoint, to create courts. And it has created the federal courts. There are almost 100 of them. And with the stroke of a pen, with the combined will of the Congress of the United States, the Congress of the United States could wipe out, and has done so almost in the past, by the way. One time there were 35 federal courts. The Congress of the United States wiped out 18 of them with the single stroke of a pen. Passed legislation to wipe them out. Why? Because they didn't like their politics. That's why. That was back in our early days. Why don't we do that today? Why didn't Congress do it? They do it for us. They have the power. They start acting up, get rid of them. And that's the way we've forgotten that. You know, Congress can impeach them individually or just end the office. You know, Congress still, all the time, it's never said, but they create courts. And they say, okay, whatever we create, we have power over. Well, that's true. He who has power to give, this is a maxim of our common law. It's a maxim of the law of God in the Bible. Job himself said, naked I came to the world, and naked I'm going out. He who has power to give has power to take. He who has power to give life is the only one that has authority to take it. When I say power, I should have said authority. And he who has the authority and to create a court has the authority to define its limits and to uncreate it, to kill it, to take it away. That's the kinds of things we need to be talking about, because if that's raised in the consciousness of people at large, congressmen might start responding to it. Well, that's just another way to say it all. Let's get to the Declaration of 76, because I am moving through it. I don't want to just stop moving and get rabbit trailing, but that was a good rabbit trail. All right. Paragraph 25, Declaration of 76, starts out this way. It says, he, who, King George III, he claimed to be king in England, and he claimed to be emperor in the Americas. Emperor. That means he is a government. His will is government. There is no representation. And the common law is utterly, he said, eliminated. Well, that wasn't true, but that's what he said. That's what made him mad. He has abdicated government here. Abdicated. What does that mean? That means he, ab means from, dictate, or dictated means dictated. He has spoken it away by the imperious breath of his mouth. That's what abdicated means. He just said, hey, ain't no more government in the American colonies. That's what he said. How did he do it? It says right here, by declaring us out of his protection. Well, that's bad enough. I'm not going to worry with protecting you anymore. But then, poor fuel, make it worse, he says, and waging war against us. That'd be like telling your children, I'm not going to protect you, or your wife, I'm not going to protect you anymore. Not only that, I'm declaring war against you, and I'm going to kill you if I can. That's what he did. Well, King George, or Emperor George, by declaring the colonists out of his protection, he condemned them. It was a condemnation under what our common law has always called outlawry. Outlawry. You got in-laws and you got outlaws. You got people under or in within the circle of the protection of the law, and you got those folks that are out of protection of law. That's a Christian doctrine, by the way. Christian. How do I know? Well, it comes right out of the Bible, and that's why it was part of our common law. God said to his people, your protection depends upon your obedience. I gave you a law, that is my will. You stay in it, and you will live. You quit it, get out of it, ignore it, you will die. Period. End of paragraph. That's what he said, Deuteronomy chapter 28, and many other places in different ways. And Jesus Christ repeated all that in the Newer Testament. It's a matter of law. And much of people don't like it. I can't change that. That's what it is. I frankly like it because I at least know where I stand. If I want the protection of the law, I have to be in the law. If I become an outlaw, the reason people were declared outlaws, and even our own country, because they were so far outside the law, they wouldn't submit to the processes of the courts. They'd be a court hearing, they wouldn't show up. Well, if they got dangerous on top of it, I'm thinking of an early American set of outlaws. They met a horrible fate. Their names were the Harp brothers. Their father was a Tory in North Carolina. He immigrated from Scotland. He joined the British. He even joined Ferguson. The Overmountain men came after Ferguson of the Highlanders. He joined them. And then his boys had a hatred. It's amazing. They had immigrated to North Carolina. They hated Americans. Well, his two boys, two of his boys, I don't know how many he had. One's, they called them the Harp brothers, H-A-R-P, and one was 6'4", and the other one was 5'9". So everybody called them Big Harp and Little Harp. Well, Big Harp and Little Harp were the first serial killers in America. And they started north, and they got up into a place, around a place called Cavin Rock, Illinois, on the Ohio River. And they operated out of there with the pirates along the river before the flatboat days. And then they ranged out all up and down the Ohio River on the south side mostly. And then when they'd get in trouble, they were declared outlaws in Kentucky by the governor. Kentucky was one of our early states after the Revolution, or our separation from Britain. The governor of the state was organized, and he declared them outlaws. So they crossed the river over to Cavin Rock, Illinois, because there was no state government there, and there were no counties close by. There was no law at all to amount to anything, except the law that Washington, D.C. sent, and that didn't amount to anything. It is estimated, and they have it on record, that these fellas killed about 50 people. They'd kill anybody they found. And first they were robbing people, but then they got so they wouldn't even do that. They just raped and killed, and raped and then killed, and they just killed anybody they found, and they enjoyed it. And they liked to do it cruelly. Now, of course, they were finally found, and they didn't give them a break when they finally had them under the posse that went after them. Kentucky, right close to, across from Cavin Rock, well, near Henderson, Kentucky, be actually closer, I guess. And there's a place there still called Harp's Corner where their skulls were placed upon poles to rot. Well, outlawry is the foundation of our present-day bounty hunters, whose jurisdiction, of course, is limited to the territory of the United States. They bring in fugitives. That's what they do, and they get paid by the mile. Anybody can do it, but you got to obey the law when you do it. You can't just run out and do it any old way you want. I knew a fellow one time, a friend. He wasn't my client, but he was a client of my friend, and he was indicted by a grand jury. He was a bounty hunter, indicted by a grand jury because he was chasing a fugitive, and he got over into Mexico. That's been a number of years ago. Got into Mexico. Well, that was a felony. That was invasion of a foreign country. But bounty hunters have been an important part of our tradition for a long time, and it's part of outlawry. People that won't submit to warrants, the law declares outside the protection of the law. Well, this is what King George did. A few more, King George, Emperor George, a few more points about outlawry. Some famous outlaws in our own tradition are John Knox of Scotland, but he wasn't a bad man. Mary, Queen of Scots, just hated him. But in the early American colonies, I talked about the Hart brothers, Sam Bass of Texas, Billy the Kid of New Mexico, and the Cherokee Kid of Oklahoma. Now, the earliest recorded decree of outlawry is Genesis chapter 4, verses 13 through 14. Cain murdered his brother. And there's a whole lot, what a story of history. But thus also did this fella, King George of England, he meant his decree of outlawry to be permanent, leaving the colonists only one choice. Secession from Britain's empire. And the most recent attempted invocation of outlawry of any note was Winston Churchill's strong urge of the governments of the Allied powers to outlaw Nazi criminals. Now, I haven't said, though, what that means. That means if you're outside the law, according to ancient common law, and the idea it was what Churchill was after, it is the sentence of death pronounced at the hand of any man who would find the outlaw. And in the early days, which I say early, up until there were no policemen in England, no policemen in England before 1820. People have a hard time believing that. It's the truth. And the first policemen were named after the commissioner of police. The first commissioner of police the crown appointed in England was a fellow. His first name was Bob. And people called him Bobby. And so people called the first policemen, which were established in London, they called them Bobbies, and they've been calling them Bobbies ever since. And those first policemen, of course, they didn't have any policemen before. Why? The same reason we didn't have any policemen here. Much before the war between the states, and even before 1840, there were no policemen. And the reason was because people in the English-speaking world have a long tradition of not trusting the government with guns. I'm repeating what the historians have been saying. People don't read that stuff much anymore, but it's the truth. And I wonder what has happened to us that we are willing to trust the government with guns to use against us, while at the same time, the English people now are totally flipped in a few short decades, really, compared to their total history, and they want to give all their guns to the government. That's madness. Sharp, Granville Sharp of England, early New Testament scholar, he's the one that said that he had studied the subject, and he had discovered that there never was a time that Englishmen, and that's the culture we have taken on, of course, the common law culture. There was never a time that Englishmen not only had freedom to own firearms, but the law required them to arm themselves and to be expert at arms. That means good marksmen. And that's what our common law tradition requires also. But this thing about outlawry, Pollock and Maitland of 120 years ago, historians of our common law, no mean proportions, they said that common law's outlawry, I'm quoting, is the sentence of death pronounced where there are no police constables or professional hangmen. Well, if there's no policemen, that's what outlawry is all about. And that's why it's still used in the United States in the form, as I'd said, bounty hunters under the federal statutes even. To pursue an outlaw, says Polycombe, and knock him on the head as though he were a wild beast was the duty of every law-abiding man. Well, as a matter of fact, in old England, I'm talking 1,000 years ago, outlaws were called wolf-red. That means their head was worth no more than the head of a wolf. And if a fella did find them and was physically able, he had the right to kill such a man. Or if the decree of outlawry, by the way, the decree of outlawry in those days, believe it or not, was only delivered by juries. Of course, outlawry came later to be delivered by kings, which isn't common law due process. Outlawry was a decree of 12 men impaneled that were your neighbors in old Anglo-Saxon law. Many colonists in America sought the king's favor, King George III, after his decree of outlawry, and his reward by turning on the outlawed patriots of America, hunting them down and killing them. And King George sent his army and mercenaries to murder them. Remember I mentioned the Harp brothers. Their father, Mr. Harp, I don't know what his first name was, he lived in North Carolina. He was one of those kind of fellows. He was a ruffian, but he worked as a Tory hunting down patriots. And if you got hunted down in those days, if the bounty hunter didn't kill you, you were hung 3 to 9 times, not enough to kill you, just enough to make it miserable. And then you were taken, cut down while you were still alive. And then you were disemboweled, and while your bowels were taken out, laid on the ground or on a table. And then you were drugged by the heels on your back or your belly, whatever they felt like doing at the time. By that time, of course, you'd been unconscious, and they cut your heart out, too. And then they cut your body into pieces and impaled it someplace so everybody could see it in different places. So this Harp, he was a nasty man, but his children, he paid the price. He thought it was fun, but he paid the price in that his own boys suffered the same fate and they had the same bloodlust he had. Outlawry is not a bad idea. And that's why in the Bible takes it a bit further. The Bible says if you're accused of murder, you can run into one of the cities of refuge. And by the way, those cities were established on the island of England. Established on the island of England, according to the law of the Bible. During the days of Multnunus, in the earliest centuries of Anglo-Saxon England, back around the year 500, we know that because his history was written and we can read it. So all of those things have been an important part, and that's the mitigating part. If you know you're wanted for murder, you think you're innocent, or you think you're guilty, it doesn't make any difference. If you flee into the city of refuge, in sanctuary, to wait until due process was completed, you could save yourself from death. And that's the way true outlawry was to be practiced. Other than that, you're fair game, and if you're dumb enough to come out of the city, after a certain period of time, you might get killed, and it wouldn't be the outlaw or the bounty hunter's fault, or what they called in those days the kinsman redeemer, who would avenge the blood of murdered relatives, the near kinsman redeemer. By the way, Jesus Christ in the Bible is the near kinsman redeemer, and all of that, the law of God, was to point to him as our brother, born of woman like us, and our Redeemer, our near kinsman Redeemer. Man, you can't make this stuff up. God can put it together, though, and he did, the Creator. Well, King George sent his armies and mercenary out to hunt down Americans, and he meant his declaration of outlawry to do that. According to common law's outlawry, even if the king's false declaration was not enough to justify the colony's separation from Britain, to be sure, the king's declaration put loyal colonists in real danger. Separation, however, demanded that the colony show real injury, And they do that, of course, in paragraphs 26 through 29. And paragraphs 2 through 24 show that injury was by indirect means through deceit, scheming, manipulation, abusive working of the courts and law. Paragraphs 25 through 29 of the Declaration of 76 show direct, open, high-handed, and notorious acts of war, such as murder, kidnapping, plundering, terrorism done in treachery. The Declaration of 76 uses the word perfidy. That's an old word. Paragraph 27, not 26. That means treachery and cruelty. And records of British murder of colonials reveals merciless brutality. Hunting down colonial patriots as though they were wild beasts to be killed for sport. I mentioned a while ago, Ferguson commanded the unit of Highlanders, Scottish Highlanders in North Carolina. He heard about the Overmountain men lived on the other side of the Alleghenies. He sent them a message. He said, come back. If you don't come back, I'm coming after you. And when I find you, I'm going to hang you. I'm going to disembowel you. I'm going to cut your heart out. I'm going to quarter you. I'm going to do that to everybody that doesn't come back. They got the message. They read it. They talked about it. They said, well, he means to kill us. There's no sense going back. No telling what a crazy man like that would do. So they took up their guns and their rations, and they took off immediately. And they found him at Kings Mountain, North Carolina, and they killed him, and everybody was with him for near. When people threaten you, whose business it is to kill, such as military people, paramilitary organizations, when they say they're going to kill you, that's probably what they want to do. I mean, the justification in my mind would be, I've just read cases about people that threaten killing people and have a gun in their hand. And the other fellow kills them, and then the question before the jury is he guilty? Well, I wouldn't think he would be. If he's got a gun in his hand, wielding a weapon, and threatens to kill somebody, if you don't kill him, he'll probably kill you. Well, every case has to stand on its own merits, every tub on its own body, and every skin has to hang by its own tail. Did I say a tub on its own body? I meant tub on its own bottom. That's what everything has to do. I'm just talking about general principles. These are the facts of history. This is what happened in during the days of our separation of Britain. Americans were outlawed, and then he came after them to kill them. And I just went over some of that. Because King George had bound himself to the colonies, and they had bound himself to them. Remember I talked about the oath of Diffiadio. By his denying them the common law's protection, he broke faith. And the colonies were therefore within their rights to break loyalty to him. That was the feudal connection. I use the word feudal lightly. They didn't use it about themselves, but it was the same principle as that's how order was held. Everybody made promises to one another, bound by oath, and loyalty to each other. And everybody defended their little parcel of real estate, their little piece of land, and in doing so, they defended the law of the land, and in doing that, they defended everybody's land, and the allodial landlord coming right on down the line, they defended all their land, and that defended the land of the small landholder. It was a beautiful system in many ways. It took everybody back to the land, and it was almost impenetrable, but King George did not apply that in the American colonies. There was no commonness here. He just said, I'm in charge. I'll do what I want. If I want Congress to make laws for you, I'll let them do it. If I don't, I won't. I'll appoint the judges, and I'll tell them what to do. He did all those things. It wasn't that he always did all those things. It was that he said, I have the right to do that anytime I want. You know, we get things upside down often. The Boston Tea Party. The Boston Tea Party. They threw the chests of tea into the sea, into the harbor. And people, of course, think that they were mad because the tea tax, they raised the tea tax, the tax on tea, without representation. That's not it at all. They didn't raise the tax on tea. Watch this. They lowered the tax on tea. They lowered the tax on tea. It was a matter of principle. And the colonists said, you can neither raise nor lower the taxes without our consent. It's a matter of principle. We're not fighting over money here. We're fighting over what's right. King George said, well, I'll let you have your courts, and I'll let you have some freedoms if I want to, but if I don't want to, I'm going to stop. Well, see, they didn't want to put up with that kind of talk and that kind of attitude. And no one should. Is that what we hear government saying today? Well, you can do what you want as long as you want, but just remember, you can believe what you want, but you can't practice what you want. It just gets worse as power in government grows. At what point? Well, as I say, at what point? Well, as long as the courts are open, we need to be talking. But what bothers them more than anything, they're not afraid of force, they're afraid of talk. And what they're afraid of, and more in that vein, they're afraid somebody will figure out how the courts work, and they'll figure out how they do it. And once that happens, the cat's out of the bag. And then what will they do? Because without the courts, then it's just, well, they don't know what they do. That's what it is, without them controlling the courts. Well, that's what happened. So King George sent his army, his navy, the Hessian mercenaries, which were his subjects over in Germany. He was a German. And the Indian tribes, not all of them, some of them. Some of the Indian tribes joined forces with the Continental Army. By the way, and you can read about that. That was not all of them, but the Crown of England tried to stir up the Indian tribes against the colonists, just as they stirred them up against the French, and vice versa. The French stirred them up against the Americans and the English. The war is an ugly situation. That's why we want to avoid it as much as possible. Nevertheless, the American colonies never revolted against Britain. And our war for separation was no revolution. No, it didn't just, wasn't, revolution means to revolve, coup, revolution, assassination. And then it comes around again. In 10 years, you do it all over again. In another 10 years, you do it all over again. Look at Argentina, look at France. That's why Bastiat wrote the law. He was a Frenchman. He was so wary of his own history, a revolving war. That's called revolution. Never stop. Why? Because there's no law. The law of the city is founded on revolution. That's all it knows. That's all it's ever known. Why do you think they had the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, and all the other revolts and revolutions? The Americans never did that. They said, look, we've got courts, we've got common law courts, we've got common law legislatures, we've got common law understanding, we have juries. We just want to continue with our common law. And we did. It was a war of necessity of self-defense, though, because the Crown of England had declared us outlaws and had declared war on Americans. And so it was a just resistance before God and the world. There are some very famous Bible teachers that say that it was unjust. Most notable among them in our own day, a very learned man named John MacArthur. John MacArthur. He teaches that the American separation from Britain was sin. So it's fascinating to me. I want to read the history of his family. Maybe I understand that a little better. But that's enough for today. Thank you again, John. There's about 30 minutes left, I guess. John and Gerard, if you're
okay.
There.
Thank you, Brent. Okay, Gerard, are you there? If you're there, you want to take the board. If not, we'll move on. You here?
Yeah.
Okay, let me just push to the next person for you, and then you can take the board. Let's see. It should be Ed from Connecticut. You got the mic. Gerard, you got the board.
Okay, Ed.
Yeah, hey, how you doing, Gerard?
Good.
I'm glad you can hear me okay. Yeah, I know some people that were over in the court, watching Crystal's situation there. And I'll be brief because I know that obviously Crystal spoke about some things. But, I mean, basically the judge is saying that that Connecticut doesn't have to follow the Constitution.
Connecticut
and,
doesn't have to follow the Constitution. I'm sorry.
Right. Yeah, I know. And the funny thing, right, Connecticut is a Constitution state. It says it. I used to say it on the license plate, right? Constitution State.
I think it still does.
I'll check my plate tonight. But anyway.
You can put a big, a big arrow through, you know, one of those circles with the arrow. You know?
But that's,
to make it safe.
But that's what, and, you know, I just thought that the Constitution is the template for the whole country to follow, and that you have to meet constitutional muster. Like, you could come up with any law you want as long as it meets constitutional muster. But, you know, that's what I thought the Constitution was about. And it's just like a comparison of you know, hope it doesn't throw anything off, but it's like Connecticut State condo law. Any association to do anything they want as long as they follow Connecticut State condo law. They can't come up with something that's against that. You know, so you just, that's your, it's just like anything, a charter of a city. You have to follow the charter. You know,
yeah,
so.
I'd like to just add something here. How you doing, Ed?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if Crystal is still here.
Good job, thank you.
I don't know if Crystal is still here. Hopefully she is. Look at what's going on in that court. There must be recordings going, and if there's no recordings going, hopefully there's people doing affidavits. You know, you got enough people doing affidavits where you get a recording and then you have it transcribed or you get a transcript of these hearings. I mean, this judge, it clearly shows his lack of any desire to give Crystal due process or anybody in this court. He's out of order. And that would be so powerful in the federal court to bring that kind of a recordings or transcript or affidavits concerning the fact that that he doesn't worry about the fact that he's not going to give anyone he's not going to obey the Constitution. He's not going to adhere to anyone's unalienable rights. So that's an important thing. You got to build that stuff up. When anybody gets it before a judge or talks to these people, you got to get the affidavits. You got to get the text, you know, or the recording, and use that for your federal case. But go ahead.
Right. Oh yeah, no, thanks, John. Yeah, I mean the thing is, if at least could be cleared up about the Constitution. I mean, it's either the states have to follow the Constitution or not. Now there is a thing that maybe someone gets confused on. The states do not have to follow federal law, but I always thought the states would have to follow the Constitution.
Well, yeah,
that's for the whole
when they were brought in, their Constitution had to conform to the national Constitution, or they wouldn't have become
true.
A state.
Yeah, but that's not true that the states don't have to follow federal law. That's not true at all. No, they do have to follow federal law if it applies to them. A lot of federal law is supposed to really apply to the, you know, to the acts of Congress, okay, which they have 18 powers, and they're able to write laws concerning those 18 powers, and anything concerning that affects a state under those 18 powers. And Congress has written a law, you know, like, you know, the idea of just moving products from one state to another, okay? There's laws, there's law on that, the moving of commerce, and many other things. So they have to adhere to wherever the power and the authority that the United States has, which is given to them in the, by the Constitution, which, remember, you know, all the states signed up on. And they've lost their power and control. The states have lost their power and control of Congress and the United States government because the 17th Amendment stole their power to be able to have a vote in the Senate by having their own senators. The whole process of two senators for every state was for the legislators and the governors of a state to be able to control and have their say in what takes place in Congress and in the United States government as a whole, and they get that by a vote, and that was taken away from them. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't even possible for them to take it away. And that's how dumb we are. We've really, really lost it. Because their ability to do that is not there. We read in Article 5 that no state, without its consent, shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. And yet the 17th Amendment removes that ability of a vote, that suffrage, removes the ability of a vote, and turns it over to the people. Now, why would they turn it over to the people? Because the people already have representation. It's called the Congress, okay? In the states, had that authority, you know, representation through the Senate. So the 17th Amendment says the Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state elected by the people thereof. Okay? And that's in contradiction to the body of the Constitution. You cannot change the body of a Constitution through an amendment. Okay? I would imagine the only way you could change the Constitution in any way, shape, or form is a full constitutional convention. But even that is still bound by common law. So I don't see how they can really make that change. But they did it, we've already advised the governors and the legislators of the states that they have every right and every power and every authority. We've written in our papers when we address them that they have every right, all the power and the authority. They can nullify the senators of their state and send two people they want. And then they can rest on Article 5 of the Constitution, and you can't negate that with an amendment the way they did it, without a constitutional convention. So therein is the problem.
Yeah, it was right.
Well, it's good to know that. On a whole, they have to follow the federal law. But the reason I did mention about the states not following, because there is 11 states that require two-party consent for recording, and federal law says it's only one-party consent. So you have about, 39 states that do follow the federal law with the one-party consent. But then there's 11 states that that want two-party consent.
Yeah, but again, they'll not win that. I don't think in a court, because look at people. First of all, if you're at a conference, why would you need two parties' consent? That doesn't even make sense. But if they give one or two, you put a number to it, that doesn't make any sense at all. Any person that makes logical sense that's involved in a conversation could record a conversation. And I know there are states, but that's kind of a hard one to argue or debate. But the bottom line is this. As far as the Constitution is concerned, okay, each one of these states came into the Union with agreement to this Constitution. And they're stuck to it. That's it. They have to obey it. And the authorities that the authority we gave to them is clearly defined here. And anything it takes for them to do to make this Union much more perfect, to establish justice, to ensure the domestic tranquility, to provide for the common defense, to promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty, that's where they have their powers. And, of course, we have in Article 1, Section 8, all of the different authorities that Congress can write and give powers, the right and power of Congress, and to write law concerning those powers. And it all makes sense, of course, as we go through each one of them, to borrow money, to regulate commerce, to establish uniform rules of naturalization, to coin money, to provide for punishment and for counterfeiting, to establish post offices, post roads, to promote the progress of science, to constitute tribunals, and that's where they think they get an Article 3 court, one court, by the way, right there in Clause 9 of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 9, to define and punish piracies, to declare war, to raise and support armies, to provide for and maintain a navy, to make rules for the government and the regulation of the land and naval forces, to provide for the calling forth of the militia, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the district, in other words, Washington, to make all the laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying out into the execution of the foregoing powers. That's it. Now, anything there, that's their authority. And any time a state hits up against something where federal law is has the power and the authority, they have to adhere to it. Now, the argument between a recording, I guess that's a debating subject, you know. If it's a right of a people, the right to travel, but one state can't say that you have to have a license and the other state says you don't, obviously the one that says they don't have to have a license, if you can find one of those, is the one that's constitutional. The one that requires a license in order to travel, that's purely against our honorable rights of traveling, to move about. And so, therefore, the state would have to adhere to that. And that's a constitutional argument, by the way, the right to travel. That's a cause of action to be able to get into the federal courts. And remember, the federal courts, you know, they have the judicial power. And in Section 2, the judicial power shall extend, this is Article 3, Section 2, the judicial power shall extend in all cases of law, equity, arising under this Constitution, so you have to have a cause arising from the Constitution, and it gets into arising the laws of the United States and the treaties made or which shall be made under their authority to all cases affecting ambassadors over public ministers and consuls, to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, and there's a division of that within the rules of civil procedure, which I throw up one a lot, and to controversies to which the United States shall be party. And it goes to other controversies and so on and so forth. But ultimately, the courts that are involved here, you know, of course, there's a bankruptcy court. That authority has been given. So there are some other courts, but the key courts that we're concerned with, of course, is equity and law. Equity identifies with usually the contract disagreements with between ourselves, and we allow a judge to be able to make a ruling, and we have a we have an appellate process to appeal the decisions. Whereas a court of law, of course, is the jury, and by the way, equity has to conform to American jurisprudence. They have rules that they have to follow and principles, and if they don't, then they're in violation. But going into law, of course, it's the jury that makes the decision. So you got 12 people deciding there. You're probably going to get a good ruling in that court, but it's going to take longer to go through a jury trial. And it's very quick to go through a trial with a judge because most issues can be dealt with a couple of pieces of paper back and forth, and the judge makes a decision. And if he's really doing his job right, he'll make the right decision and rule for the right person as it is produced on the paper. I mean, a person could write a poor paper and be in the right and doesn't articulate their position well enough and their defenses well enough, and they could lose. But that's because they decided to stay ignorant and not have the knowledge of using the process of law, which they should. It's part of life. The judicial process is an important process to every individual in America, and we don't realize it. We don't know it. We all need to become educated.
If you have there's eight people on and you're taping it in those states, you got to tell everybody you're taping it, right?
No, he just needs to have two, he's saying, right? There are 11 states.
Two. Look at that two-party thing is a bunch of bullshit.
Well, New York is not. New York isn't one of the 11 states, fortunately.
If you live in a like New York, and you're on a phone conversation with any public thing or bank or government, and you tell them you're recording, let me tell you what, they will hang up. They are told not to go on a phone conversation that's recorded because they commit liabilities and it's documented. And that's why they want a two-party thing. Look, anybody that calls me or I call anybody, I should have a right to document that conversation. I shouldn't have to let the other person. You know, suppose he's harassing me. And I go, oh, well, wait a minute. By the time when you're making this harassing phone call,
you can make a logical case. You can make a logical case right there. That makes sense.
Anybody that I'm on with who I decide, never mind I got to tell him or them or anything like that. Yeah. And I'm telling you, they will not talk to you if they know you're recording.
Hey, they come out to you and record you. You know, when the feds come out, they record you.
any bill collector that calls you, if you tell them that you're recording the call, they get right off. That's a good way to get rid of them.
Yeah, I mean, 39 states agree with you. And the caveat, of course, is just as long as you're a party of any conversation, either in person or on the phone, you could record it according to the 39
well,
states.
You have to be a party. That is a good way to get rid of these people, though, when they call. You could say, well, this call is being recorded for quality and training purposes.
Right. Yeah.
Say, what do you want? Click.
It's
That's
true.
It.
But yeah, it would be good. I mean, if this thing, you know, with the Constitution, I mean, it would be so easy that people could rely on saying, look, we have this Constitution, and as long as everything meets the constitutional muster, then you're okay. I mean, how simple, you know, that could be. And how come there's these arguments and talking about the Constitution isn't what it was? I mean, it is there. The president talks about the Constitution. A lot of famous people talk about it. Judge Napolitano talks about the Constitution all the time.
The way they do it is Title 26, the income tax. It didn't confer any new laws. It is constitutional the way it's written, and you volunteer yourself into it. And once you do that, you're bound by it. And so they feel
but even that is fraud, though. Even that
I understand,
is fraud,
but
because they're not
that's
being truthful.
Doing.
But that's how they wrote it up. You're right.
Right. They do. It's a technicality, right?
But they still don't have the power because it's not a court of law, and it now is a court of equity, which is running ultimately as a nisi prius court, an administrative process, statutory. Therefore, they don't have the power to fine or incarcerate, yet they do. So you see, even there is another problem with the way they run things. And they know it. It's just because we're so dumb. Look, everyone in the legal system is well-trained by the Bar Association in statutory process, in statutory and statutes and the rules. That's where their training is. They have no training in the Constitution, no training in the common law. They have no clue about any of those things. And the people don't seem to be interested in learning anything until they get caught up in the courts, and now they try to get out of it, and they find themselves being beat up and incarcerated and fined and they're scratching their head. Well, they haven't been awake to protect their rights. Well, you can't go to sleep. If the people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. It's not going to happen.
Listen, another big one where they deny the Constitution and they do it blatantly, and they've done it a lot in the recent past since people have been creating, you know, congressional questions and oversights. And they is national security. They'll tell you, oh no, there's no constitution in over here because this is a matter of national security. They got to repeal the 1948 National Security Act because that look at when they were asking the Congress and the DOJ and the FBI and all this for paperwork, they said, oh no, we're not going to give that because it's state secrets. What do you mean state secrets? And they even tell the president that the commander in chief and the chief officer of the CEO of the United States that they're state secrets that he can't get. Well, he's elected by us. These people with national security, who are they? They're military. They're appointed. We have no control over them other than the president. He's the last stopgap. How could you say that the president is not entitled to any issue of national security, everything? Who killed Kennedy? Why? Anything like that? It's ridiculous to think that they can hide it. Because who are they? Obviously, they're outside of the constitutional government, right?
Hey, we only got a few minutes left, and we got a few callers in there, so maybe we should move on.
Okay, thank you very much, and I'm happy what you're trying to do for Crystal. Thanks again.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Ed.
Okay, I'll take the next caller. God bless Crystal. She's a real
hit the right
whip.
Button now.
I got it. This is old news, John. Okay, there's no name here, but you've been opened up there.
651.
It looks like. What's that?
Oh, hi.
Yeah.
Hi. I have a question. Okay, if I'm in Minnesota. I go by Feather. Okay, you were talking about outlaws, and I don't really have a great question today, but for now I was just going to ask that, are targeted individuals considered outlaws by somebody, and then how does that relate to any rights they may or may not have?
Well, listen, I understand where you're going with this, targeted individual. Look, at the Patriot Act made us all enemy combatants, and in a certain sense, we're all outlaws according to that.
Okay.
Basically. But you know what I mean? Is that what you're talking about, a targeted individual, somebody the government's going after?
Yeah, especially someone who's being attacked with, I don't know if you guys allow people to talk about this, excuse me, it's my first time, so I don't know how it goes here. But especially people who feel that they're getting, let's call them frequency attacks.
We're familiar with that.
Delicately. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I did read something about...
Look, Brent said that normally you can't become a targeted individual unless a jury of your peers declares it. It's not up to the government to say you're a target, that you're an outlaw. Because you have to do some stuff that somebody actually says, okay, even if they subpoena you and then you don't come in, well, that's a forfeit anyway. That's a default. If they send you a summons and you don't show up, well, you lost. So that means you agree you are a criminal. But basically, it's supposed to be done by a jury of your peers, and we know the Patriot Act has nothing to do with that.
Right.
You know, they're just doing it because
the FISA courts.
Well, the FISA courts, I don't know, that's a little different again. Yeah, I guess it all goes in there, yeah.
I think the FISA courts are involved, and I think usually it's some sort of a slander, and then they put you on some list, you know, and set the whole thing, the whole ball rolling. But
and that's all under national security,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
So, and what is national security? I mean, what... You know, they gave them sweeping powers with that National Security Act. We need to repeal it. It's not necessary. We understand that they're state secrets, but, there has to be some control and there has to be limits. When you have people in Congress and the president asking for certain things and they refuse to give it, to me, they're out of control. They're way over the top because what they're saying mm-hmm. is they don't have to answer to the people. You know, we understand that, you know, national security, something that would cause, you know, an international incident or a world war, it still has to come under the under certain controls that ultimately we the people are controlling by our representatives, let's say, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes.
I don't know. It's just leaves a real bad taste in our mouths in this day and age.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting that whole theory of the outlaw or the whole idea of the outlaw, and I feel like I may have read that somewhere as well, that some of the people that target these persons are sort of bounty hunters, you know, and mercenary types, and so it feels like it's sort of the same theme. So in modern day.
Well, I'll tell you what, if I wanted to carry on the legacy of Donald Trump and operate the way he operates, I would say we the people should get together in our juries and declare some of these officials as outlaws, and they could be hunted down on site, and use that law against them.
Interesting.
I can think of a few of them, that we could call outlaws. And look at if we did it with a jury of their peers, we would be doing it in a more legal fashion than they do it, than they're doing it.
Exactly.
You know?
That's true.
I mean, Obama was killing American citizens. With drones and with no due process, none whatsoever, and he got away with it. We were stupid, you know. The Congress, the Senate, they let him get away with being that kind of a dictator. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Anyway, your point is well taken. Okay.
Thank you. Thanks.
You're welcome. I'm going to take one more, and then we'll have to go because it's 12:01 already. Okay, so we got Heather from Utah. Go ahead, Heather.
Hi. So I was wondering, I filed, or you guys helped me file with my paperwork to do the non-judicial foreclosure. And I actually got served today from the sheriff with papers. It's a summons. I have 3 days to answer. And it is for complaint for unlawful detainer. So I talked to Jim, and he suggested that I just send my paperwork and a letter to him, just asking him if they could hold off on this until I get through, you know, the Supreme Court or whatever. But
well, the summons was for what?
It's for complaint for unlawful detainer.
Unlawful what?
Detainer? Yeah.
D-E-T-A-I-N-E-R.
Okay. Well, you need to answer it. You don't want to ignore answering, because then they'll default on you. So you have to be careful with that. Let me see what I can. I don't know if Brent's here, if he has any.
Unlawful detainer. Can't you just answer
I'm
it and
I'm
say
looking
not,
that up
not enough information? Denied.
What are they talking about? Do you have any idea? Action of detaining or withholding property. Oh, detaining or withholding property.
Right.
They're trying to take your property.
Yeah, right. They're trying to get me to leave my house. They foreclosed on it and left.
Did they change the title names? Did they change the name of the ownership on the titles?
They did.
Okay, so that's what they're trying to do. It's a process. You need, and they did this without going to court, right? Non-judicial foreclosures. Yeah, this is the process they use. Okay, and you and I believe you did do paperwork through us, and I think that was recently done. Now, you're going to have to think about going into the federal court for violating your due process. They're not going to be able to throw you out very quickly. They'll have court hearings and so on and so forth, and then it'll probably be one hearing, so you got to be careful, or maybe two at the most. And then they'll give you so many days. So, yeah, I guess it is pretty close. You got to be careful with this. But you can't not answer. That'll be a default.
Right. So what was suggested was I'd send him a letter and ask him, send my paperwork with a letter and ask him to hold off on this.
When do they want you to go in? How many days?
I just have 3 days to answer in writing.
You got to respond within 3 days?
Yeah.
That's what they're saying.
And they want you to respond in writing?
Yep. And I just got it this afternoon.
Tell them that they illegally took your property. Share with them the paperwork we sent, and tell them they illegally stole your property title, and you're going to take this to federal court because they've taken it without a judicial process. They didn't have any authority or right to do this.
John, what's that procedure when you go in federal court and you open a case up, but you just stack the paperwork in it for a future date, and they give you a docket number? There's a name for entering evidence into the federal court, but not actually running the case yet.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know.
Well, I've heard the word lodging, and I hear courts use it. Lodging, yeah, lodging a case. L-O-D-G.
Because what I'm thinking is if she could go and lodge the case and then take the number out of the federal court and say, "This, I have a case that's going into federal court on this, and here's the lodging number," that might make them think twice about moving forward. I mean, that way she has more time to actually file the case. I don't know.
I don't know either, because I just hear the courts use that word. I don't know that doing that is making a difference, but I do know saying to people sometimes, well, maybe you'd like to explain this to a federal judge, if that's appropriate. I wouldn't want somebody to say that to me. You know, that's like you take people for a ride that way, even if you know you can't win. If you think you've got a case and you don't think there's justice in the courts, the court still will take them through the process. And that's not a pleasant experience. Sometimes that's a necessary way to deal with people, to get them off your back. But the particular procedure you're talking about, I'm not familiar with. I have to confess ignorance of it.
I just don't know how she's going to get a case filed in 3 days. I mean, she has to answer this.
Uh-huh.
Well, she's going to answer this, and then she could move the case into federal court for cause. And you could do that relatively quickly if you can run your paperwork quick enough and file the papers everywhere you need to file them quick enough, and that will help to stall the case. And then again, you need to now win the case that they're coming out after you to take your property without due process. As a matter of fact, they have gone so far as changing the names of my title. How did they do that? That's the question. You see, And you got to take that into the federal court that you're not getting due process in this case. And again, you got to stay on point.
They went with the in rem process, and they feel comfortable with the in rem process that you did have due process because it's in rem.
Well, what's very interesting is if they filed it in rem, the only way that in rem comes to play is ultimately on the federal level. There's nothing in the rules of the courts or anything that I'm aware of on the state level, at least not in our state. There's nothing in rem, really. There's a reference to rem in some statutes, usually county statutes, which they have no power authority anyway. Maybe there's a state statute that makes a reference to it, but it has to be filed someplace. There has to be a proof of claim under an affidavit, and there has to be fiduciary authority. Generally speaking, that's a federal issue, I think. I know that at least it is a federal rule.
Well, look at the whole New York State Real Property Law, Section 5, Section 5, is it? It used to be 10, which was the
normal. Is that
where
you find
process.
The in rem?
And it's all in rem. That's right.
Okay.
But
it still has to be filed then at least in the county. Where is
not,
the filing
look,
in the county of proof of claim?
They're not following the federal procedure. As a matter of fact, in order to do an in rem procedure, they're supposed to get a federal officer to arrest the property. They never do that. You know, that's what the federal rules say about in rem. So, you know, it's like they got this in rem procedure and they only use the portions of it that they see fit. And I know, at least in my county, they gave them the option of using the in rem procedure because they said, oh, it's quicker and it's easier and it frees up the deeds and more people will buy the property. You get recovery quicker of your taxes, besides the fact they're stealing the equity out from underneath them. But they were supposed to make a law. They were supposed to adopt it as a county law, and they never do. And I don't think the state even did, because I think it's so unconstitutional that they just ran forward with this in this county, they did it as a resolution. Well, a resolution is not a law. And the same thing with the state. The state says you have this option, but you can't find it on the register where every law is supposed to go in and get registered at the State Department, and it's not there. So the whole thing is a fraud, John.
Well, absolutely. But you got to be really careful, because I've never seen this done before. This is an action of detaining, and which identifies with withholding property. They're claiming that you're withholding someone else's property. And how you respond may agree, or you got to be careful on how you respond, because you may unwittingly agree with them in some way, depending on how you make your argument. You got to make it clear that this is fraud. This happened, I presume, without your knowledge, and you're just discovering it. And how did they perform this? Where is the proof of claim that they've got somewhere, which is an affidavit? Where is the proof of fiduciary authority, which is another affidavit? And where is it filed? How come it's not filed in the county? And all they're doing is filing name changes and different changes. I'm not sure even of the paperwork that they use in the filings in the process of changing, the property over. What they like to do is get you to leave the property, because generally that's usually what happens. Once you leave the property, they make the claim because they claim to have an interest in the property and that you abandoned it. And in that abandonment, now they could take ownership of the property. And that's a way that I guess they do this. But they've been doing it with people still living in the property.
In this county, in my county,
you've got a question to understand how it is that they're doing this.
In my county, they do it immediately. And then they send you a notice. They send you
Well, that's for taxes, though, right?
Yeah, well,
and I had a 30-day notice and a 2-week and a 2-week and then a 3-day and a 3-day, and I still didn't leave the property, and that's been about a month ago. And I did file, I think the papers that I did for the non-judicial foreclosure has been filed. I think they received it is why I got this.
Well, you know, we got to look into that part of it. You see, the 3-day
mortgage. Is this a mortgage foreclosure for sure? This is not a tax foreclosure?
It's not tax. I guess it's for mortgage. It's through my loans through rural development. my lone wolf.
Well, look,
okay, so that
they're
is
serving, but those notices that they're serving, we need to get copies of that to see how they word these things, because therein must be some of their magic, you know, that they're using and claiming that you've abandoned. If you don't at least respond to those notices, then they're claiming no one's there to respond, so therefore you abandoned it. So we got to think that out on how people respond. But first we have to understand the paperwork.
John,
so anybody who could share us that paperwork.
I can send a copy of mine. And the last one I received didn't have a letterhead on it, didn't have had a signature, but not a printed name, no address, no phone number. There was no contact information at all whatsoever.
How many papers have they served upon you in that way, and you know, telling you to get out or whatever? They've been doing this for years, or just recent, or what?
No, just since January.
Okay, do you have all the letters they've sent you?
I do.
If you can get a copy of all those letters, a clean copy, you know, get a nice scanning, and get them to Jim, and Jim will get them to me.
Okay.
Okay?
See, once they,
and I'll
once
look
they
at
change.
That, because it's interesting to know how they're doing this.
Once they
all right,
change,
and Jim also has a copy of the summons and the detainer papers. I give them to him today.
Okay, but get all the other stuff. I'll take a look at that, too, and I'll see how they're doing this, you know, because they have to have a procedure here. Go ahead, Gerard.
Hey, look, once they change the name on the deed, whatever they do to get to that process, then they just kick you out as a scofflaw tenant.
Yeah, but how do they get to the changing of the name of the deed? There's a game going on here that we're not aware of. I mean, we know it's there, but we don't know what it is. And look, we should find it in the paperwork, the game that they're playing. We just have to analyze their paperwork and see what the game is that they're playing.
Well, I know that when they change the name, they don't like to let you pay, because they say, oh no, now there's legal fees. But when I had my case in court here, and I went in, somebody called up and she said, okay, you got to pay it. She said, but you need to come in, because now we have to do legal work to put your name back on the deed. So they
change
both ways.
Yeah, but that's on the tax issues, though. On the tax issues, they play a different kind of game. They can get away with a lot more because they're claiming an amount. But you know what? Even that, they don't do it with a sworn affidavit. The guy will put a signature on it, usually someone in the county, but there'll be no certification of that signature. There'll be no notary. Now, but the point is this. If we can get the paperwork trail on what they're doing, and analyze that paperwork trail to see what they're doing, we may be able to create a response process where people get this, they respond this way. They get that, they respond that way. That may prevent them from feeling comfortable, because somehow they feel that they got some procedure going on which is unlawful to begin with, but nevertheless, they have a confidence in this procedure because, after all, that's the law, you know, from their perspective.
And nobody's answering them.
Right.
So
the thing is what needs to be done to neutralize. Hang on one second. What needs to be done to neutralize every one of these steps? How do you respond to that? But again, we have to understand the game, and we can only understand the game by reading all the series of paperwork.
Listen, just responding, John, to each one of those is going to put a monkey wrench in their works, because
they
have a timeline. They have a timeline that they want to go through.
Right,
and
you see, every time
and they pretty much just ignored me, and they'd send me another letter, and I'd respond to that, and they'd ignore me, and then I found out later that
they're operating, I'll bet you, like a notice and demand here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you're responding by a letter. You're not responding by putting something in the court.
Right. I found that out later.
In other words, there should be when they're coming after you for that. There should be a docket number. There should be something. Of course, it's non-judicial, so they don't need a docket number. I don't know. I mean,
she can go get a number and deposit it in the county somewhere. And we'd have to look into that to see. Maybe Brent.
I mean, how are they operating?
Or you could pay. But listen, there's other things that could be done. You can open up a court case without opening up the court, not getting any judicial intervention, but just open up a place where you can file your papers. But again, that eventually becomes a court case. You got to realize that. But you can start putting the paperwork there And then you'd have to treat it as a court case, though. And maybe that is the way to go. We'll have to think about that, think that out. But here's the key thing. If you respond and you certify everything you do, you certify every paper. As a matter of fact, even get someone else to write an affidavit of service through the mail on your behalf, and that really tightens it right up. And you do a notice and demand back to them. So the thing is we can maybe write up a plan of response to these papers that they're sending, and that may totally prevent them from moving forward.
Yeah, and I did the notice of demand and all that when I was responding to them, but idea where I didn't take it through court, they just ignored me, and they were all sent certified mail.
Yeah, but they'll ignore your notice and demand. They're looking at their paperwork, and they figure you're going to give up. They figure you're ignorant to what's going on. They figure you can't afford a lawyer. They figure you're not going to get a lawyer, and they figure you don't know what they're doing. And so they keep moving. And every time they move, they get closer to a part of satisfying some kind of a procedure that they got set up. And then once they satisfy that procedure, then they make the next move, and they keep moving and moving. And before you know it, all this compiled together. Maybe they're claiming that with all your lack of responses and so on and so forth, and their notices that you've abandoned the property, so they make the claim. I don't know, but I'm presuming it's somehow that way. Because they're taking the property, claiming it's being abandoned. I think that's the game they're playing.
I did try one other thing to stop my foreclosure. I don't know if this helps any or not, but they said where the property was mine and where the deed was in my name, and I had listed them as the beneficiaries and whatnot. I went in and filed with the county and put it on public record, and I did a revocation of deed and just took them off. And that was about 3 or 4 days before they went ahead and took it my property anyways. So I don't know if there's any legal issues there where I took them off as a beneficiary. So they had no right to it. And then they went ahead and sold my property and changed the title anyways. But I did file that with the county, so I don't know if
that's because the clerks are ignorant. See, the clerks let them get away with that.
Get us a copy of all the paperwork you have on this. We'll take a look and we'll try to figure out what they're doing. And how they're doing it.
Yeah.
All right, LDR.
All right.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's 20 after, so we're kind of a little late there. Anyway.
Yeah, we're going to shut down now, so.
Yep. Okay, thank you, everybody. Thanks for coming, and we'll see you same time, same place next week.